Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast. My name is Willie Simpson.
My name is Sonya Rappaport.
And I'm their friend, Matt.
And Matt returns to us from a previous episode, Slave Island in Season 1. Welcome back, Matt.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Sonya, why is Matt here?
Because he's cool.
Thank you. Sonya.
But why is Matt specifically here?
You know, sometimes I feel like you're setting me up for these situations that I don't know the answer to.
The real answer to the question is we've been watching X-Men relate, watching, reading, thinking about, or whatever other verb I can, it's not coming to my mind right now, about X-Men related things since a very young age that we've known each other.
That's true. Me and Matt have known each other since we're 4 years old. And today, I guess if no one's going to say it, I'll say it. We watched X-Men 2, X2, X-Men United, The Last Stand of X-Men, right?
That's
the next movie. X2,
2X. Yeah, X2. X2 United again.
It's X squared X-Men United.
The second X-Men?
Yes. Internationally known as X-Men 2, I read. That's true. I read that on Wikipedia.
That's a distinction between the international and domestic market for this movie?
In America, it was X squared, X-Men United, with the subtitle.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
X squared?
Well, no, it's X2, but I think they put the 2 like it's squared.
There's a little 2.
Superscript?
I think it is. I could be wrong about that.
I thought we were just making a joke of how many iterations we could make with 2 and X.
We're doing that,
together.
But we're also trying to figure out what the title actually is.
All right.
But anyway, this is a special bonus episode where we continue our promise to review and talk about every X-Men movie that has ever been made. So it's taken us a while to get to number 2, but Matt months ago told me that he wanted to specifically do this podcast, so we've been holding off for him. So it better be good, Matt.
That's
everything
true.
You have to say.
No
it's
pressure.
A lot of pressure.
All right, so Matt, I think one of the reasons you wanted to be in on this was that we actually saw this movie together as teenagers when we were, I don't know how old, in the year 2002 or 3 when this came out.
That's apparently true, but when you told me that earlier today, I didn't remember. No offense to you. I don't remember seeing it in the theater. Mm-hmm. I do remember seeing it in multiple viewings afterwards, obviously. I wanted to come back because I saw that you all did the original X-Men film, mm-hmm. Interspersed through the...
you were entertained by that episode?
I was entertained.
Okay,
and,
very good.
I think in particular I wanted to set up for doing the third, which is a ridiculous abomination, but I suppose that you'll get to that next,
Well, it depends on how antsy we get to do the third one. So if your schedule lines up, you're always welcome back to do the third one, but we'll see.
Stay tuned, listeners.
There's only 20 of them total, so you'll have your pick to do X-Men movies. So before we start jumping in here and talking about the movie, Matt, I want your opinion because you weren't in the last one. What do you think of X-Men 1?
I thought that it was at the time or now?
At the time. Also, I want to say we saw that movie together as well when we were 16.
We sure did.
Yeah.
I think I remember that
yeah,
one.
Yeah.
I think I remember that
you
one.
You were 16 when that came out for sure.
So. Yeah. At the time, I thought it was like a fun – for whatever reason, I remember tempering my expectations.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Maybe because they're making – like my expectations – as I discussed – in depth in the episode that I joined, the animated series episode I joined you with several months ago, but the expectations of the animated series were so on such an unbelievably mm-hmm. high level. For whatever reason, I remember my expectations being tempered and met with the first X-Men. Just it's like entertaining and fun and faithful, and I remember having a good time and being like, hey, that was a pretty darn good movie.
Well, I remember specifically after we saw that movie in the movie theater together that we were both so excited by the ending of X-Men 1 because there was a clear promise for more. When Professor X is visiting Magneto in the X-Men – in the plastic prison.
Right.
And he's like, the war is coming.
That's true.
And Professor X is like, I intend to fight it.
So we were just elated that they had committed to a
– yeah. Like it was like a verbal promise to the audience.
Although you know this better than I do, there are a lot of setup movies in the superhero or other genre where they don't – where it like bombs.
Right, yeah.
And they actually – and they don't proceed even though they're committed by the – by the plot.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was – happy to see the return of X-Men and X2, X-Men United again.
All right, so let's talk about the title. It fucking is terrible, I have to say right off the bat. They couldn't decide between X2, X squared, and then this subtitle of X-Men United, which I don't think describes the movie in any meaningful way whatsoever.
Well, doesn't it describe that the villains of the first movie are working together with, you know, that Magneto and Mystique are working. That's the United.
Yeah, but Magneto and Mystique are not X-Men.
That's true. X-Men are united
with their mutant brothers.
I read on Wikipedia, they said this movie was like clearly made. They wanted to make an Empire Strikes Back of the X-Men series.
Interesting.
With the point being that, spoilers at the end, all the characters are kind of split up and separated. So in that sense, they're not united. If the goal was to split the characters up.
Right.
I mean, they sort of unite towards the climax of the movie in a way, but not in like a way that's like, now we are united, our powers can combine to create the Ultra Force that will blast into the sun. It wasn't like that.
My assumption is that the studios title these movies, and it's like something where the writer, whoever has, you know, however much ownership they have over the whole thing, they're like, yeah, you know, okay, as long as it's not some stupid title.
I mean, I get X2, like, and obviously it's a play on X squared, the mathematical, phrase we're all familiar with. the popular phrase, like, somehow they thought that was cool. But X-Men United, I find lame. Just call it X-Men 2, you know, and that's what I've always called it. Mm-hmm. I never referred to it as X2 or X-Men United.
I think now people refer to it as the only good sequel, right? So
of X-Men?
I don't think refer to it just as the second one, the good one, right?
Yeah. Right. I mean, that's how I always thought about it for years and would have continued to think about it. But I read a lot of modern-day criticism of this movie online where people are not fans of this movie. They think it's either been dated or it was overhyped or sort of like not all it was cracked up to be. And re-watching it with you guys, I had a damn good time. Right? I mean, so let's talk about our impressions of the movie. Like, Sonia, what did you think just sitting through this thing in the year 2018?
Totally entertained. I have, like, a notably bad memory for movie and television plot devices and stuff like that. So, like, when we sat down to watch it, you were like, oh, this will be fun. And, like, sorry, you mentioned it. Just spit on you a little bit.
We're all leaned in really close into one microphone for three people, so.
You mentioned, like, one major plot point that hadn't happened yet, and I was like, really? That happens? Like,
yeah, that's right.
Was, like, going to be surprised. Yeah. So, I mean, but of course, as I'm watching it, like, it, you know, it all comes back again. All that said, I was entertained, and I think, like, when I've referred to this movie, it's never by a title. It's like, yeah, that second X-Men movie with all the adamantium. And then, like, you know what I'm talking about.
Right.
You know?
All the bubbling adamantium.
Yeah. Right.
Which is a very satisfying image to see. I found that very interesting.
Yeah. I agree.
Matt, what do you think, rewatching it all these years later?
I think that it's aged well. I remember liking it a lot, being entertained, like I said, watching it a few times, you know, whatever, on cable or, you know, afterwards. And I liked it. It's a great movie. It's a great Marvel action superhero movie. Like, probably one, I don't know how many have been made in the last, like, 20 years, not just Marvel, but, you know.
Oh, 42.
It's probably, like, top five or something like
really?
That.
Really? You put in the top five of all Marvel movies.
Well, I put maybe of all of, like, the last 20 years of, you know, comic...
Well, I mean, this was at the beginning of the comic book explosion. Well,
and I think, and maybe, I think a lot of it comes from very low expectations, mm-hmm. to be honest, especially...
This time
now.
Around?
Well, it's weird, right? Because you just said this is one of the one of the first of the last 20 years, you know. But low expectations of the way in which both the Marvel universe, Marvel film universe, whatever, and the comic book movies in general have progressed, you know, recently. So I have, like, low expectations just in the sense that there's a cogent plot. There's things happening that you understand how they connect to how the actors, the writer, and the director are trying to move the movie forward. There's motivations that, you know, there's, like, motivations of the characters you understand.
Clever twists.
Yeah, yeah.
Good acting.
True.
Right.
That's all true.
These novel things.
Things grounded in reality a little bit.
Yeah.
Right.
So maybe it's low expectations, but it's just, it's a well-constructed and a lot of fun.
I agree. I really enjoyed rewatching this with you guys. I thought maybe I wouldn't like it as much rewatching it again because, first of all, I've seen it a million times, and you know, and in a sense, as fans, we were betrayed by the promise of this movie because, you know, Bryan Singer left, and then X-Men 3 was terrible, and there's a bunch of other bad X-Men's before it kind of rebounded, and even the rebound ones, while very good, they also there's something lacking in them, and that and they kind of paled in comparison to the birth of the MCU with the Kevin Feige led universe, where you could tell they were really doing a good job with the Marvel properties. And so there's like a bittersweet thing where it's like, oh, I wish Marvel controlled X-Men because they would really be knocking it out of the park, whereas Fox is like hit or miss. However, then that's debatable. A lot of people think like now Fox has reclaimed their mantle as the top superhero storytelling group because of movies like Deadpool and Logan. So, you know, it's hit or miss, I would say.
But because this is the second one, they're still kind of feeling out what they're going to do with a superhero genre. I think they, like, took a lot of the successes of the first one and applied them here. For instance, they, you know, coherent storytelling is, like, a good one, you know, that didn't, like, make it through all the superhero movies that came afterwards. They, like, kind of poke fun at the aesthetic of it in the first one, where they talk about the costumes and, like, oh, would you prefer yellow spandex? You know, like those types of jokes, like that sense of humor carries through.
Yeah.
I don't in particular like the, I hate to like use this terminology, but like the dark aesthetic of it. Everyone's very like black leather clad.
Yeah.
And that did kind of like get put into other movies that came later. I don't know if it was because this was an example or like if that was just a general feeling of like, oh, we need to like make superheroes serious.
And there's,
looking,
like, dark
or...
dark settings, like, you know...
there's, like, a Batmanization of things.
Yeah,
I see that.
But, I don't know, I thought this movie was colorful enough. I know you mentioned that...
Not as colorful as, you know, like, the X-Men First Class, you know. Has a certain, like, 60s patina color. But,
right. I read on Wikipedia that they said the visual influence of this film was Road to Perdition. Another movie I saw with you in the movie theater.
That is quite a specific, like,
I know, yeah.
There's a lot of movies there, and I was not expecting Road to Perdition.
I know. A movie I have no desire to ever see again. Yeah, I don't know. I didn't think it was too uncolorful. I like that they continue the trend of the characters when they're in their street clothes. They wear colors that reflect their comic book costumes.
Yeah, that's true.
But when
that's
they're
nice
in the
X-Men... service.
Right, yeah. When they're in their X-Men costumes, it's still the black leather. Although, I thought there were some tasteful updates. Like, I like that Storm's outfit seemed a bit different. I mean, maybe it was the same as the first one. I just can't remember. But I liked her long silvery cape in this one. And I like Jean Grey's long
she
black
leather
jacket.
She had that, like, space foil on the inside. Like, the stuff that you... when you're
Mylar.
Like the Mylar, like, when you're found after an avalanche... They wrap you in it, so
yeah, that was cool. That was a good touch. You know, like Jean Grey's outfit had like pink X's on it, or like red. I guess they're red, but it was nice. I thought, you know, the movie. If you're going to criticize the movie to me, you would be criticizing the look and feel of it, because it is very much looked like it was made in the early 2000s.
Well, that's the part of it that's dated, really.
You know?
I don't think the storytelling aspects of it are really.
No, they're not.
Going to get dated, you know? Like,
a little bit, maybe, we'll go through it. But, like, things that bother me, like Sean Ashmore's, like, frosted tips or something. And that was an accurate period detail, but it still just bothers me. I don't even know if his tips are frosted, but they're certainly gilled up in tip-like ways. You know, stuff like that. You know, like, the in-sync scene is kind of, like, obnoxious.
That's not timeless to you?
I don't know. It's just something that bothers me about this day. But I mean, there's not much to say more about the setup. It was the sequel. We got the sequel, and it was very, very well executed.
Yeah.
And I agree with you, Matt. I think it does, like, hold up in the overall pantheon of Marvel superhero movies.
Yeah.
In an era before there even was an MCU.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's... You know, people really praise Spider-Man 2 from this era, too, as a great movie. I think this is better than Spider-Man 2.
I think so, too.
It's more rewatchable.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's more relevant because you still have a lot of the actors. Like, Patrick Stewart and Hugh Jackman just finished doing the roles last year.
Then the thing that both of those benefit from, Spider-Man 2 and X-Men 2, and what the Marvel and other superhero filmmakers and fans have really realized in the last couple of years is just skip the if you can, just skip the origin story and just lead right into, you know, benefit of people like vague, even if they just vaguely know who the X-Men are or who Spider-Man is or whatever.
Yeah, like, it's nice. Yeah, and it's like they do, like, it's not like you abandon an origin story, you just hint at it. So there's some flashbacks in this movie.
Yeah.
There's some fan service as far as origins go, and some rearranging.
It's like
of
a
details.
Wolverine origin, you know, but sort of told
Well, they're teasing it out. In the first one, they also teased out Weapon X, too.
Right.
So they're teasing it out again here. They're not telling the full Weapon X story.
Right, but he's searching for his, you know...
Yeah. And then but the thing is, that's why this movie's sad, because they really were doing things tastefully, and they promised a lot of stuff that they just blew out of the water in X3 and X-Men Wolverine Origins. Mm-hmm. They, like, ruined the franchise with those two films. So it's like all the finely nice stuff they layered just got blown out the water. And it's kind of a shame, but whatever. Let's start talking about the movie. So it begins sort of like the last one with a voiceover. There's a speech about mutation and evolution by Patrick Stewart. And there's like a weird... It all leads up to this weird like cosmic like figure in outer space. Sort of like reminiscent of... We've been talking a lot about Eternity lately. And the Never Queen and all these like weird cosmic Marvel... like beings that exist in like the grander cosmic outer space world. Yeah. So it's like, I don't know if it was a reference to that. I mean, it's clearly a reference to the Phoenix. So this movie tees up the Phoenix in a big bad way, for better or worse. And Matt, you had like some weird problems with that as we were discussing.
I think that it borrows, it does try to tee it up, but it borrows, I thought that it borrows currency from the third movie in a way that puts... It does more than tease the Phoenix.
The presumed third movie that we, like, as the viewing X2 for the first time that we haven't seen yet, right?
I think the root cause of the issue is that it does more than tease the Phoenix. It introduces it, like, full on is, you know,
without really telling the audience anything about
it. Like, why the Phoenix? Why do I care? What is this, you know, like, what is it? It's just, like, a thing that's some weird transformation that's happened to Jean.
Isn't that what happens in the comics, that it's, like, the Phoenix comes out of nowhere. It's a new storytelling beat that Chris Claremont just interjects.
It does, but then in the comics, it quickly like hugs around it to like to create. It's like a seed that you know what I mean.
Well, this is one comic as a movie, and then the next comic is the next movie.
But I have to wait 2 years.
Right? Yeah, I hear you. So I mean, if I think it's fine the way they handled the Phoenix in this movie. They left it open ended enough that they could have gone in any direction. And after seeing this movie as fans, I was like, I think the feeling was like, yeah, they're going to do a good job. X-Men 2 is a good movie.
You have no reason to not think that.
Yeah, they've really seemed to like nail the X-Men as best you can in this format. And I have no reason to think like, and the movie was a huge hit when it was released. I think it was like one of the top grossing movies of all time when it came out.
Oh, really?
Or maybe one of the highest grossing weekends ever. Mm. So you would think as fans too, it's like, oh wow, Fox is going to make a lot of money on this. So why wouldn't they pour all the money they need to make the Phoenix movie correct going forward? And then you learn that Fox, like, for whatever reason, the executives at the time running the studio hated the X-Men franchise for some reason, and they were always trying to cheap out on it. And
yeah, because of Rupert Murdoch and
his anti-mutant agenda.
His arch-conservative anti-mutant agenda.
He sympathized too much with the Senator Kellys of the world.
That's right. Tell me Rupert Murdoch wouldn't support the Mutant Registration Act, listeners, tell me.
Well, what if he himself was a mutant?
He probably is a mutant. That's why he hates mutants. Yeah. He is a self-loathing mutant.
Self-loathing mutants, yeah. That'd be a funny premise for a movie. The self-loathing mutants, men. So that's how it opens. We get another one of these like weird voiceovers, and it's like one of these weird 3D triptych diagrams of... In this case, in the first movie, it was like we're seeing genetics, like a trip through genetics, and now it's a trip through the Cerebro machine. Hmm. So Cerebro is, as we all know, is like a big part of this movie. So then the movie actually has like an awesome slam opening in the White House.
It does.
Of all places. Matt, you want to describe the scene?
It does. This might be the part of the podcast that I filibuster the most, so please, jump in and humor me if we spend more time on a 5-minute scene than other parts of the movie. But I love this introduction. And I think it probably is the best, you know, of these little vignettes that they're at the front of a lot of superhero movies. They're at the front of a lot of action movies, especially if it's presumed that the audience already knows the characters or knows something about the story. So like James Bond, for example, has like a 5-minute story of like some like weird little intrigue or something that that sets the tone, how they want to set the tone for the movie. And so I really love this one because I think the most important thing that it establishes is it being in the White House and being like an attack on the Oval Office or whatever. It establishes that you're vulnerable and unprepared for mutants. Mm. It's the most like secured most important person in the world,
right.
And it was like so easy for this co-opted, you know, it was pretty easy.
And from an X-Men standpoint, it's cool that they're just like out the bat introducing Nightcrawler.
Yes. And so that also, I don't know if that obviously is a compounds or it's a force multiplier for me, because like as a comic, mm-hmm. as a, you know,
love
X-Men
him.
Fan of the comics, it was kind of like, you know, in your child's mind's eye about like what are you, when you take advantage of the movie as a, you know, as the artistic medium or whatever, it's like take your favorite character in like the coolest scene you possibly
yeah.
could when you're like a 9-year old or whatever, and it'd be like Nightcrawler would be like bouncing from this inside this room, he'd be dodging this thing,
and you're putting him in the White House
and
of all
yeah.
places,
and yeah. that, and they kind of they nailed it without it only being like, we, you know, I guess the listeners can check me if I'm like way off on this, but fan service to someone who's like a fan of
yeah.
you know the character.
It is like it's instant fan service.
It's a lot of tension too that builds up from like who's this stranger mm-hmm. when he's like in the raincoat or whatever to like he's evading this thing. They don't know who he is, and it slowly ramps up to like he messes up one person, and then it's like four. He does this thing, mm-hmm. and then before you know, it's
you
a,
see how
it's,
awesome
it's
he
a
would
lot
be in real
of
life.
Like
yeah.
ramp up of tension, and then. You know, I think that scene, even though, like Will and Sonya pointed out, you know, the 3D or the color scheme, the veneer of, you know, hasn't, you know, I think it's aged pretty well, but
it still looked okay.
I think that scene still looked okay, which
yeah.
is like the bare minimum, you know, sort of thing. So
I
so,
love
yeah.
that blue smoke they give him.
His Banff.
Yeah.
I was a little disappointed in it. Because
really?
To me, Nightcrawler has like a purple Banff, and it's more smoky.
Is that a real word?
Well, in the comics, it is Banff. That's the sound that is supposed to be made.
I was also unfamiliar with Banff as a term of art. So.
Is that BAMF?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So, I mean, it's okay. It's a blue Banff, and it's not as smoky as I'm like. It should be like a more fiery purple brimstone Banff. I forget how they do it, because Nightcrawler comes back as a new, younger actor in X-Men Apocalypse. I forget how that looked like.
Hmm.
But here, it's fine.
I like it. It's swirly. It's blue. It's cool.
Sweet Banff.
And yeah, and you see how like the great thing about X-Men is that all the characters are so great and so interesting and so powerful, many of them, that it's like you could just make a whole movie about Nightcrawler and be fucking interesting. You know, his powers are so awesome and great, and his look is amazing, and his characterization's great. But here he's just another side character in the broader Marvel X-Men universe.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, I agree, great opening. It's great to see. I like movies that it's kind of like a fun, like, what if someone did attack the Oval Office, what it would look like? And I don't know how true to life this movie is, but it makes you think that it's very realistically portrayed.
It feels real. I mean, there's no, you know, there's no crazy, I mean, there's probably no crazy science to, you know, security of the White House. It shows, like, you are vulnerable to mutants. One mutant that has this power, you know, to, like, teleport.
All the nameless actors playing Secret Service extras really do a good job selling it, too.
Yeah.
Because they're very cool, calm, and collected, and also very, like, at the edge of their, you know, tension and anxiety, too,
mm-hmm.
trying to stop an intruder that's attacking the Oval Office. And then, so Nightcrawler, he dispatches all the Secret Service guards, and he attacks the president. I was trying to wonder, you guys can stop me on this right now, like, what president is, like, most analogous to this guy in this movie? Matt, any thoughts?
It's President McWhiteman from
yeah.
you know, from either the Democrat or Republican Party.
I think he's a Republican.
What makes you sorry, Sonya?
Yeah.
What are you? Were you trying to say something?
No, I just was going to agree. I feel like they make him as vanilla as possible on purpose. Like you really don't get that much information about him. You need to know he's president.
He's got very little characterization. He's
yeah.
right. Yeah.
You do know one data point is that you do know that he humors Stryker. That like
yeah.
Stryker serves in some capacity
right.
In the administration,
played by Brian Cox.
Yeah,
in a very mustache twisting role.
mm-hmm.
He's really twirling that mustache in this movie.
I think that's the
goatee.
Only data point that I know about the president.
Right.
He seems to like.
I was just asking
know.
More like, what do you feel like?
What do I feel?
Yeah, not like what the movie presents.
Well,
as
I mean,
evidence.
I guess Republican. If the last
yeah.
Democratic,
well, it came out in the Bush
president
era,
was a black man, and the last Democratic candidate was a female. But so I mean,
this came out in the Bush era. You know, it's a Bush you know analogy without like being too specific. Okay, yeah, so that, yeah, there's not much about the president in this movie, although he is kind of an important character.
I mean, they don't make him unsympathetic or anything like that. It's just that, like, he's got reason to be worried about mutants.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, to, like, a mutant-sympathetic audience, we're all like, oh, he's, like, against the mutants.
And well, then, yeah. He's about to be stabbed to death by one.
You know what I mean? But, like, he doesn't know anything, so.
I mean, a mutant attacks him with his pretensile tail or whatever it is. Is that how you pronounce that word?
Prehensile.
Prehensile? Okay. So, all right, so the a Secret Service guard does wake up in time, shoots Nightcrawler, and Nightcrawler zaps away, and he doesn't get to kill the president. Cut to Alkali Lake, we meet a young Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. He's real baby-faced in this movie, especially in this scene, because he's in the white snow, and he looks just very, like, no wrinkles on his face at all.
Yeah.
Even though he's supposed to be 160 years old by this point or something. So the return of Hugh Jackman, and definitely more of a starring role. He was the breakout star in the first movie. And an unknown actor, we discovered, discussing the first one, recommended by, who's that other famous Australian guy? Russell Crowe recommended to Bryan Singer, that recommended to Bryan Wilson, the Beach Boys, that Hugh Jackman would make a great Wolverine. So he's going to Alkali Lake. He discovers nothing there but a wolf that just looks at him. And, you know, so that's the reintroduction of Wolverine. So that was picking up a story thread from X-Men 1. Not much to talk about there. We're just going to blow through some scene points, and if there's anything interesting to discuss, we'll discuss them. But this movie's, like, good, so it's not... There's not going to be too much to just, like, get upset about or be too opinionated about, really. So we'll see as we discuss.
Just watch us.
Right. And then it cuts to the X-Men are leading a field trip in a natural history museum somewhere. You know, and so my question to you guys is, are, like, Storm, Cyclops, and Jean, is this just their job most of the time, is just being teachers of a bunch of middle schoolers?
Yeah.
Are you asking what is the ratio of their time spent teaching kids versus... kicking people's asses for good.
Yeah, exactly. It's just such a weird job they have.
I don't know.
It seems like a lot of their time just must be being regular teachers. They've got...
Well...
You know, we saw in the last movie there's montages of them teaching courses with little kids. So that's how it seems like they're spending most of their days.
In the movie universe, yeah.
Yeah. So it's
in the comic book universe, there's 15,000 comics of them in Avengers, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. So it's like here, it's like, it's just kind of weird to be an X-Man in this movie universe that they are mainly teachers. They're real, like, sexy, like, modern hip teachers. You know, I feel like when you're a kid, if you've got a semi-young person as a teacher that looks really good, you're really naturally impressed by them and really, you want to, like, there's, like, a sucking up angle to them, and also you think they're really cool and you can talk to them like they're your older brother or sister and you look up to them. And especially that you know that, like, Jean and Cyclops are married, that's established in this movie. I don't know if it was established in the last one, but Jean says in this movie that, oh, I married him. Him being Scott. So it's like, you like also those little kids looking up to adults that are that good looking to know that they're together. You really make fun of that drama as a little kid and also are interested in it in a way.
Did you guys already do the Cyclops Jean marriage animated series episode?
The one with Mr. Sinister?
Yes.
Yeah. There's a couple of them.
Okay.
Yeah. So we haven't got to the second one yet. That's in season 4. In season two, it happens. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Sorry,
but that's a fake. That's a fake marriage.
Right.
Because Morph gives the vows, and because he wasn't the real priest,
right?
It's considered not a real wedding,
right?
So therefore,
it was quickly annulled,
right? And Scott and Jean can't consummate the marriage as a result.
No,
as we were told by the X-Men writers Eric and Julia Leewald. That's why Jean couldn't be pregnant in the second season as they wanted her to be.
Oh.
It's really insane. All right, anyway, so yeah, so there's some like real sexy teachers, I would say.
Uh huh.
And, you know, I don't know. I just think that's weird, like, dynamic going on. And then, like, you know, we see a kid with a blue tongue that sticks out, a little girl eating ice cream. Like, that seems to be his only mutant power, which sucks. It's like, all you got is a blue tongue. Great.
He probably has more powers. We
meet another kid later that his only power is to, like, to change his TV channels by blinking his eyeballs.
It feels realistic to me. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, that let's say there's 6 or 7 billion people in the world, and some small percentage have mutant powers. Like 95 to 99% of those should be like pretty milktoast powers.
Yeah,
you know,
like having
like I got a blue tongue,
like
you know?
Having a toaster for a hand. It's like, God damn it!
Make toast whenever you want.
And those people deserve. They're going to be just as much outcasts as
yeah,
the Phoenix.
Right? They're in more need of help in a way than you're right. The everyday freaks of the mutant world than the special powered ones that have perfect facial symmetry.
So that's
and
why
look like
not
Halle
every
Berry.
Mutant is an X-Man. That's how you get like just a few, just like a handful
a,
of
a whole
being
lot of uninteresting
right?
kids at that school.
But also, you never know because like part of the cool thing with mutant powers is that like. You see them manifest in one way, but then, like, the character that has them can be really innovative with them and
That's
use them
true.
For, like, a bunch of other stuff. And
it's
when you see,
true.
Like, a new portrayal for the first time, you're like, what? Like, you know, you're, like, real impressed with it. So, like, you know, maybe the Blue Tongue Kid, like, I don't know, has some, like...
There's some reason.
His tongue can never get stuck to a frozen pole. Like,
or he uses it creatively, you know, in a circumstance where
right.
he would have to prove that he just ate a lollipop.
Right.
You know, to prove something. I don't know
funny.
What it is.
All right. So the X-Men are teachers. We see then they establish that Jean's having problems with her powers, and Cyclops is aware of it. Like her powers are going a little schizo, and that's a big problem. But I like that's honest, that Cyclops is aware that's happening, that she doesn't like just keep it a secret. There's too many characters in movies where something bad is happening to them and their loved one asks, like, what's the matter with you? And they're like, oh, nothing.
Yeah,
and then the ominous music plays. I like hear that she's just kind of like honest. Mm. They're aware that there's an issue. Then we have cut to the older mutant kids. We get a new character. So we have Sean Ashmore returning as Iceman, Anna Paquin as Rogue, and this new guy played by an actor named Aaron Stanford as Pyro. He's not the like the heavily accented West End London Pyro from the cartoon. It's like, hello, mate. Meet my pal, Avalanche. And then talking to Rogue's like, you look like a sassy lass. He's not that Pyro that wears the bright orange and yellow costume. He's this sassy, like, Boston kid or something that's got a chip on his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And he's messing with some local bullies, and there's a dumb scene that reminds you it's the early 2000s and stuff.
And that they're kids.
Right,
know,
yeah.
Feels... realistic.
Yeah, and Professor X has to save the day, kind of. He freezes... He establishes that he's got the power to freeze a whole room of people, or, like, freeze time. I guess he's freezing time more than anything.
I think he's freezing all their consciousnesses. He can't freeze time, can he? He can just, like, get in your mind.
I think it's debatable, but my theory is that he's freezing, like, people's perception of time so that he can... So that if you're in his bubble, that you can act normally, but everyone outside the bubble... their perception of time is slowed to, like, a micro fraction or something.
I think we're saying the same thing.
Okay, fine. So that's established, and it's just weird. You know, since we watched the first movie, so you know I've seen about, like, 700 episodes of Star Trek, we've become, like, new fans in our late life. We've never watched Star Trek before, really.
Our late life.
Yeah, right. In our late nerd life.
Our mid-life.
In our early 30s.
For the purposes of the analysis of X-Men the Animated Series.
Uh-huh.
Right, yeah.
Their late life.
So it's just weird to see Patrick Stewart as Professor X and not as Jean-Luc Picard, because it's just, like, the same guy. It's just funny to me.
Right. Well,
I mean,
like,
the same actor, the same, like, character, same character traits.
It's just seeing him, it's Picard. That's what, he's not Professor X anymore to me, you know, as he was.
But like you're saying, it's kind of the same, like, dynamic. He's in charge of everything, and he's giving commands about stuff, and he's, like, super poised and, like, regal in his disposition. And, like I was saying before, it's really funny that he, like, chose to take this role, because we watched some interview with him after he was done filming all the Star Treks. And he was like, yeah, I needed to do, like, anything different. I went to my manager and said, I don't want to be a captain of anything. I don't want to do sci-fi. I don't want outer space. I never want to give coordinate readings again.
Yeah.
And then, like, he ends up
He decides to play Professor X for the next 20 years.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
But,
I mean, a year or two of playing King Lear, and he realized he wanted that fat paycheck again.
Yeah. Well, but he speaks fondly of the X-Men movies. He really enjoyed them. And he speaks fondly of Star Trek, too.
Right.
So I love Patrick Stewart. He's, like, one of the world's greatest humans, I must say.
Plus, like, Ian McKellen is a real-life friend of his.
Yeah, which
from,
is also
like,
great. Yeah.
Way back, so it's probably cool for him that he gets to act alongside his friend.
They are incredible. Like, the one thing, Matt, you were saying this, is that Fox does is they cheap out in the budget, but they really cast A-list acting talent to be in these X-Men movies. Which
yeah,
is
I mean,
interesting.
From those two to Alan Cumings to, James,
yeah.
like, people that were developed in this
yeah.
universe, whatever, like James Marsden or whatever, and Hugh Jackman, but it's a pretty talented...
And Michael Fassbender.
And yeah, Fassbender later.
And McAvoy, and you know, even though I don't like her that much,
yeah,
Jennifer Lawrence is an Oscar winner, and Oscar Isaac. I mean, it's like they keep getting this, like, incredible A-list role of players to be in these movies, which is like sort of the most compelling thing. It's like you really, I mean, Halle Berry won an Oscar. Like, it's a real star fest when you go to an X-Men movie, and it's pretty exciting. I mean, and it makes sense to me because I'll say it again, of all the Marvel properties, I think X-Men is number one still. Like, despite Marvel's MCU eclipsing the X-Men as a movie franchise, in general, I think in everyone's minds, especially in our generation, X-Men were the coolest. Even above, a little above Spider-Man, too. Avengers, no one even gave a shit about, you know? So forget about them. But, like, X-Men is just, like, the most interesting collection of heroes. So it is appropriate that they'd get a bunch of A-list stars to portray them. All right, and so, and then, you know, the movie, we know what the movie's about. Brian Cox, he plays William Stryker, this military colonel who runs a black ops operation. He wants to kill all the mutants. So he's cooking up some scheme. He's got an assistant played by Kelly Hugh. Her name, she's playing Yuriko, Lady Deathstrike, who we saw in the X-Men animated show. A much more subdued version than what we saw in the cartoon, wouldn't you say, Sonia?
Yeah, I was saying while we were watching that I felt like it was kind of a shame that she didn't get a little more backstory, exposition, or even dialogue. Does she have any lines in this? Like, she barely talks, if at all.
She has one line, I think, in the whole movie.
Right.
Yeah.
I just think it's a shame to subdue her character that much, even if they're not going to go into the full backstory.
She looks great. Like, it's a really cool character.
Yeah, but like what we see from her in the X-Men comic and the cartoon is like so... She has so much personality.
Yeah, she's Wolverine's ex-lover, whose father was the guy who created the adamantium bonding process, not William Stryker, some other guy. And she then genetically modifies herself to get adamantium, weird, like, fingernail claws.
Yeah.
So, and we don't see any of that in this movie. She's just, like, a mindless drone.
It's a sad story, too. She's, like, not really a villain. Right?
Yeah,
she's
exactly. Just, it's a tragic.
She's captured, sort she of, brain-controlled.
She's brainwashed, yeah. So brainwashing is a big thing going on in this movie. You know, there's one... I just got to mention before we move forward, there's one, like, insanely stupid line... When Stryker is talking to the president about his plans, he wants to invade the X-Mansion because he shows the president there's a jet underneath the school. He's like, what's going on here? So the president gives him authority, but now Senator Kelly, who's secretly Mystique because Senator Kelly's dead, tries to like confront Stryker about this. And now because Mystique is playing Senator Kelly, Senator Kelly has switched his position on mutants. He's now pro-mutants. And Stryker lashes out at him in the halls of the White House. He's like, I was leading Black Ops helicopter missions in Vietnam while you were still sucking on your mama's titter in Woodstock. So don't tell me about like how to like go after the target.
Right.
And I just hate that line so much. It's like the most generic thing a military guy says in a movie.
The sentiment is, you know, the sentiment is interesting that he's turning... You know, this senator that maybe used to be a philosophical ally that is now taken over by Mystique or whatever, switched his position. You know, he has reason to be pissed at him or to say, like, listen, I'm a professional. Yeah. Like, I've been doing this.
But it's the most cliche movie line, right? I mean, we've seen it in I can't name a movie, but it's just been in a million movies where some military guy says that to some younger person. But it's also weird that he says that to the Senator Kelly actor who looks like he's in his 60s.
Right.
Not, like, at the time in 2000, that's still a little too old to be a baby at Woodstock. But whatever, fine. And then Wolverine returns to the X-Mansion. I thought the scene was funny because, like, immediately he is the man. Like, Rogue comes to greet him. She's all over him. And her boyfriend, Iceman, is jealous. Right away, like, insanely jealous out of nowhere. And then Halle Berry and Famke Janssen come strutting down the stairs in their, like, tight, like, beautiful outfits, like, all over Logan 2, like, flirting with him and, like...
They're not flirting with him. They're saying hello.
No, they're completely flirting with him.
They are not.
It's like, oh, look at this stud muffin that's walked in the doors.
No one says the word stud muffin.
They said that with their eyes.
No.
Matt, back me up.
I think you're reading a bit into it. I think, you know, they're buds with him, right? Because they just went on this wild adventure vis-a-vis the first movie.
Right.
And he's like, I need to go find myself in a spirit quest now. And, so they're, like, happy he's home safe. Right?
Yeah, that's true. But it's still...
But also everyone loves...
They're all, like, winking at him and, like, giving him, like, the cat eyes and stuff. And he's... you can tell... And Hugh Jackman's reaction to those moments, he's very much flattered by all the attention. And he sees Cyclops, and Cyclops is immediately jealous and... like, annoyed to see him again, too. Mm-hmm. He's like, fill up my... You wasted all my gas on my motorcycle. Fill it up, you know? that kind of thing. So
I think Wolverine's just happy for human interaction. He's just been hanging out with wolves.
Yeah, that's true. Excuse me, drinking too much beer. So then we meet Magneto. He's in the plastic prison still.
Which is awesome.
Why do you like that?
Because it's a great balance of something really cool. Like, I guess it's similar to my explanation for the Nightcrawler intro. It's something really cool. It's so comic booky.
Yeah.
Like glass or plastic prison.
Yeah.
To contain it's like bizarre. Magneto at like the center of the Earth that sort of has feel.
Someone had to figure out the range of his powers.
So I guess it's like okay, here's why. The amount of disbelief that you have to suspend to wrap your mind around the plastic prison is so far,
yeah.
Yet it's not that far of the leap. They make the leap easy, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Find yourself, when you're watching those scenes in the plastic prison, I find myself, like, trying to poke holes in it, being like, that guard, his button is definitely made of metal. And then,
maybe they get closer to him, I don't know.
I'm like, oh, no, it's plastic. Oh, but the pen, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, every little thing, like...
There's so much that is silly or realistically impossible about that, but they make the leap.
But that's
the comic
like part
book
of what
to
makes
movie
it cool,
leap, yes,
you know?
They make it
is like your attention is really like drawn into the minutia of it.
Yeah,
I like it.
Another thing I didn't like about the only thing I didn't like about the scene is Magneto, played by Ian McKellen, who's great again in this role. He says something stupid about the like he's worried about the taxpayers. Like, I feel like that happens a lot in these movies where some supervillain is captured. He's like, oh, I wonder how the taxpayers feel about you, like, keeping me in this laser grid prison on the moon. And they're like, shut up, Ultron. You be quiet. And there's always this, like, dumb taxpayers joke about prisons that are constantly... And to me, I wonder if there's, like, this weird thing in screenwriters' minds where they just assume the public is outraged by the cost of prisons. I mean, like, we should just execute the criminals instead of like treating them and putting them in 5-star hotels.
You know, 5 drudge alert sirens. It costs a lot of money to imprison Magneto.
Yeah,
you know, like it's you know
you'd be
you're
gonna
have to build a moon base. You know, when you have to,
right. All right, so that's Magneto. He's doing fine, I guess. Well, not really. They're beating him up with plastic billy clubs, and they're also brainwashing him. And then we establish Cerebro again. Logan visits Professor X in the Cerebro room, which still has no guardrails for a man that rolls around in a wheelchair, which is kind of dangerous. Professor X lets loose the vital piece of exposition that is the crossing the streams moment of this movie, where he's like, if I concentrate too hard on any particular person, I'll kill them. Which is the entire premise of the movie. Brian Cox, William Stryker, wants to kidnap Professor X to get him to use his own makeshift Cerebro to concentrate on all the mutants in the world, so he gives them all, like, brain aneurysms and they all die. So that is the overreaching plot in the movie. To me, it's a very much crossing the streams, Ghostbusters, like, nonsense sci-fi business, but at the same time, like, not totally unclever.
I think it's clever because you know, it's the thing, it's the MacGuffin or whatever in the movie that, you know, they're all that it's a person that it's Professor X is the weapon. And that's the thing that they're all trying to, like, wrestle from each other.
Right. He's technically the most powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I like that it's better that than, like, there's a 400 nuclear bombs in the center of the Earth.
Yeah, it's better than a blue laser.
There's something out in whatever.
And then, you know...
And the threat's super real, too. I mean, it's like, he could kill all the mutants.
Right.
He could kill, you know...
Well, you're talking about the threats in the X-Men movie are better than in all the other Marvel movies.
Yeah, I think that you have more running room, I think, and a lot more... It's easier to make more compelling threats in the X-Men universe, I think, because the entire story is set up for X-Men versus human.
Right.
That's the conflict.
So it's better.
And also, within it's like whatever, man versus man, man versus machine, whatever, man versus animal.
Man
but
versus
so there's
Colossus.
X-Men. There's certainly X-Men versus X-Men too, right? Like the Magneto you know, Magneto and Professor X philosophical struggles. But it's mostly just about, it's about, like, you know, a new scary thing that humans have to wrap their minds around dealing with. So I think that allows a lot more running room and potential than a lot of other franchises.
Right. I've said it about X-Men before as a franchise in general. It's got one of the best science fiction premises, like straight up science fiction writing premises, that, like you just said, there's been a new change in humanity, and they keep emphasizing in the movie with all those dumb monologues at the beginning, like, and how does humankind react now with this new, like, thing that no one expected or anticipated, and it's very scary, and it's all grounded more in reality. And that's going to be the most exciting thing about the X-Men returning to Disney, in the sense, just because it's always just been the best overall background noise of the Marvel Universe, that there's these mutants appearing now everywhere, and that, like the world order is a bit destabilized from it, and it affects all the superheroes, whether they're mutants or not. And that's been missing for me from the MCU, that you don't have this undercurrent stirring the pot that, like, grounds it all in much greater realism. Mm. So I hope they're going to be able to reintegrate that in a very satisfying way, and I think they will.
Mm. Do you have faith in the Disney, you know...
Yeah.
Do you have hope?
I do, because I think they know that X-Men is, like, their secretly their best property.
Huh.
I think they really, like, believe in it from that standpoint.
They secretly know that X-Men is a better property than Star Wars?
Well, they definitely... No, not necessarily Star Wars. I think it has the potential to be as big as Star Wars. That's my personal feeling. Mm-hmm. They haven't... If they give... We saw Thor 3... And they look like they poured, like, all the money in the world into that movie. And that's the third sequel to Thor, who's an also-ran, like, fourth member of the Avengers.
Right.
And that movie looked gorgeous and was amazing and was funny. And it, like, was incredible to see. It was like a comic book come to life in many ways. And, like, but that's Thor. The X-Men, there's so many characters. They're all so much more interesting than a character like Thor. The premise is so much more interesting. Just the potential, it's like everything about it to me is just so much more potentially spectacular. I think Disney knows this. Like, because each character, like I said, could almost have their own movie. Wolverine clearly can have his own movies. Mm-hmm. You can do movies about Magneto and Professor X by themselves. You can do movies about Rogue or Storm.
Yeah.
You know, like the angles of them alone are just so compelling enough as it is. So they're going to have, they're just franchises onto themselves. And to me, it's going to be wonderful how they're going to decide to, like, split up certain characters and re-merge them into the main X-Men movies and do the spin-offs and bring them back in again. I just think it's all going to be great. But I know, like, the corporatization of it is awful, and the whole Disney taking over their universe. And
you're pretty, you know, you have high hopes for their stewardship of the franchise.
I really do. I think they're not going to
do, like, X-Men versus Avengers versus Alien versus Predator.
I mean, they're probably going to do that too eventually. You know, they're going to, like, keep merging them in ways that's really obnoxious, where they'll have Wolverine on the Avengers. I mean, that's going to happen, and that's going to be stupid. You know, they'll have stuff like that, but I think it's going to be better. I don't think fans are going to be complaining or as nervous about it as they were about Star Wars being taken over by Disney.
Hmm.
You know, I think they're doing a reasonably good job with Star Wars, but at the same time, it's like there's a lot to criticize, and there's a lot to wonder, like, why is this, why, you know, with Star Wars. But with X-Men, it's different. It's meant to be serialized. It's like there's millions of years of comics to draw upon, and it's spectacular in many different ways. So I think it'll be good. All right, carrying on here. I like to see, and then, like, I like that we see Jean and Storm in the Blackbird together. Passing the Bechdel test as two powerful, independent women. So I really enjoy that as, like... And I think we're going to get more of that with these future Disney movies as well. More powerful, like, mature women, like, being great superheroes. So you get a little taste of that here, but it's just... It's nice to see, like, two characters like Jean Grey and Aurora Monroe together, like, flying a complicated jet, going on a mission. In this case, to find Nightcrawler.
Very satisfying.
Yeah, and Matt just gave me the 10-minute flashing sign. So our guest, Matt, all the way from Washington, D.C., is lucky to be in our presence in Brooklyn today.
Very lucky. And so lucky.
We, for some reason, we started watching the end of Godfather 2 when he came, before we got to X-Men 2, which is a long movie.
It's a good segue, though, because it's a great sequel.
Yeah. Right, yeah. It does have that in common with the Godfather 2.
Was that the common thread?
Right.
Was that the only thing? Because as we were watching X-Men 2... at some point, like midway through the movie, you're like, this is just like the Godfather part.
Well, I said that as a joke.
I was wondering.
Yeah. So Matt has to leave in about 5 minutes, so he's going to quietly exit at some point. So actually, with only 5 minutes or so left with you, Matt, let's summarize some thoughts here you had about the movie, about the X-Men, about anything you want to talk about, you know, about the government shutdown today in Washington.
You know, good movie, bad shutdown, happy to be on the podcast. X2 has aged well, still a good movie. And if anyone in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is listening, if anyone at Disney is listening, if anyone that has any influence in these movies is listening, I know that for whatever reason, they've gone from these tighter scripts, you know, the different sized action and tension scenes paced at the right points, you know, in the movies, to these like 2-hour and 40-minute runtime, just like
overstuffed,
designed for audiences in China. I don't know what, but if you're listening, I think that if you go back to cogent stories with plots that make sense, that get driven from A to B to C to D, with characters with motivations that you understand, you'll make money. You'll make money.
What a clarion, like, call.
You'll make money, I think. You'll make money in China still. You'll make money in the international market.
Well, what movies are you criticizing specifically here?
Name a couple, you know, from the last...
Yeah.
I haven't... I heard the last... You know, there's been good... You know,
yeah.
I haven't seen the recent Thor movie. Like,
right.
I heard it was
good. I liked it, yeah. You might not like it.
You most famously
always tell me I turned it off after 10 minutes.
Yeah. I think most, if not all, of the Avengers movies and, you know... Like,
they've been a little awkward.
You know, like, I think the Captain America, I think the Winter Soldier was, you know, not perfect, but, you know...
That was good.
It was good.
Okay, good.
Know, but because I think that the scope, you know, was pretty limited.
Right.
You know, it's not like... These people have to save the world, and that's the end, and then, like, fill in the middle with a bunch of stuff. That's what I'm sorry.
Is that what fan service to China is supposed to be? Because that's, like, something that I've heard, like, said around, like, oh, now film executives want the movies to sell in China. So what changes...
Well, I think what we've hit on already in this is that X-Men 2 is modeled after the Empire... If this is true, if it's modeled after The Empire Strikes Back, it's meant to, you know, to not have necessarily, like, a bright, we did it, high fives at the end.
Yeah.
It's meant to sort of disperse the characters in both, like... How does Wolverine move on from the trauma? How does Cyclops move on from the, you know, what is the next steps for this? Like, there's clearly going to be a next thing because mutants and the whole plot of X2 is like, you just fucked, sorry if I can't swear on the podcast.
No, you can.
You just fucked up the world with you almost killed every human in the world.
Right.
Clearly something is going to, you know, you're going to have to resolve that. You know, it's setting something up for the next movie.
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing. And even though there's lightness throughout the movie at, you know, select points of, you know, humor and other points, it is a darker sort of grappling with identity thing, like Wolverine's identity in his past and and betrayal and, you know, all the heavy X-Men stuff,
like Jean Grey's
discrimination
evolution
and genocide, yeah. And, you know, and Jean Grey and blah blah blah.
Their relationship, the love triangle.
I think that's the thing that doesn't. It's maybe uniquely.
Doesn't sell in China.
I don't know how to put it. Uniquely Western, or it does. It's not Transformers 9. You know, Rise of the Robots. So
that's funny.
But that's a entertaining movie. I recommend it.
All right. Well, let's some quick stuff before you go. And these are dumb questions. What was your favorite scene of X2?
Clearly the intro.
Oh yeah, yeah. The intro. Nightcrawler. Yeah.
Yeah. Without a doubt.
In the White House, yeah. I love that scene.
And it's not to say it was all downhill from there, but no. I think it was like the, you know, the rocket fuel, you know, that gets it into altitude.
Worst scene. Where were you like, this is dumb?
The Iceman's jealousy. Yeah. Although maybe it's not dumb. It's not it's like, I get it, because he's like 17, but it's kind of grating.
Yeah. I really don't like his portrayal. no offense, Sean Ashmore, you did a good job, but there's something lame about the way they characterized your character there.
Yeah, I guess that's...
All right.
But it was also funny to see Wolverine react to that, so I don't know. It was pretty self-aware scene.
Yeah, yeah. All right, how many X's out of 10 X's do you give this movie?
I give it, out of 10 X's,
yeah.
I give it 10.
Whoa!
Because the way you frame that... Yeah. I give it a 10 out of 10 of, like,
it satisfied,
you know,
your X-Men desires.
It's a good bordering on great X-Men movie. That's
right.
What it is.
I think
that's
you're right.
What it
yeah.
was intended to be, and that's what it fulfilled.
I
so,
mean, it's
like,
traditionally always been referred to as the best one. I know there's now all this revisionist history about it, but to me, I think you're right. I still think it's technically the best one because it holds the most promise. And because X-Men 1 was a really good setup of the characters, and I love all the actors in these movies, it's like there's still something, you still get that nice, those good feels when you watch this. Like, man, they're really like going somewhere with this in a very compelling way,
mm-hmm.
and very enjoyable movie. So, Matt, I want to thank you for stopping by. We're going to carry on with the podcast in a second here because there's so much to talk about X2. We can't let our fans down. They've really been scratching for this one. But I do want to thank you for coming by. You're welcome back anytime. If you can make it for X3, you have to sit for the whole podcast that time. You're really going to have to scope away some hours.
I'll definitely be here for Wolverine Bone Claws, whenever that is.
Well, that's in a several movies. So
I'll be here for that.
All right, very good.
It's been an honor, and I'm looking forward to listening to the rest of the podcast.
All right, thank you for coming. All right, an abrupt continuation. Now it's just Sonya and I to talk about the rest of the movie. Sonya, how are you doing?
Holding up.
All right, very good. So where we last left off, we were talking about Jean and Storm flying around in the Blackbird looking for Nightcrawler.
Yep.
They find him. He's in a church, which is appropriate for the character
because
he's very religious, as we see. You know, they capture a lot of elements. Like, this church, it seems to be an abandoned church of some kind.
Or under construction.
Yeah, something. He's got, like, all his stuff there.
Seems like he lives there.
Yeah, he lives there because he hangs up his posters from the Munich Circus or whatever it is.
Yeah,
that's
weird.
Yeah, because Nightcrawler famously was like a circus act. You know, he uses his tail and stuff, and people thought he was wearing makeup, I guess, was the premise. So we get to meet Nightcrawler. There's like a cool scene where Storm uses her lightning to blast him off a church steeple, and... I don't know if it's a steeple, but like some wooden support beam, and then Jean freezes him in the air so he can't escape, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then they meet him, and they're really sympathetic to him. It turns out that all his markings on him are tattoos he did on himself.
Mm-hmm.
Were they tattoos, or did he, like, cut himself?
I think they were tattoos.
I think he actually, like, carved into himself.
Oh, really?
Like, scars. Yeah.
Oh.
He said for every sin he commits, that's how...
He does one, yeah. Yeah.
And they discover that he's got, like, the weird, like, circular burn mark on his back, which we know is the brain juice secreted from William Stryker's son, Jason,
mm-hmm.
that he's been using to mind control people. It's just
right.
pretty gross
it, like,
plot
burns,
detail.
Like, acid, like a little circle.
Yeah.
That spot on the spine really creeps me out for some reason. It,
yeah.
like, gives me chills to, like, think
it's
about
really
it.
It's really gross. Now, everything about Jason and, like, the juice they get from him is really disturbing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll talk more about him in a few minutes, I guess. All right, so we meet Nightcrawler. I mean, he's, like, not exactly, like, what we expect from the comics. I think in the comics, Nightcrawler's a little bit more, like, happier and dynamic.
They make him, like, less... It's funny because they, like, over-sexualize Wolverine in a way.
Yeah.
Like, Hugh Jackman is this, like, real attractive version of Wolverine.
That women are into in
right.
this movie universe.
And not just that they're into him, but, like, he's just good-looking, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas, like, in the comics and the cartoon, I never really imagined him as that, like, magnetic. Because he's got, like, this grumpy personality. He's, like, hairy and, like, sweaty all
short,
the time.
Very short.
Like...
Nothing
yeah.
against short guys.
No, but it's just, you know, like, the movie really, like, makes him more attractive in their portrayal of him.
Yeah.
Just by casting Hugh Jackman, but whatever.
And the audience's subsequent reaction to him in the first movie. He was, like, a breakout star.
Right. Whereas, like, Nightcrawler, I kind of thought had the potential for that to happen, too. You know, like...
Really?
I kind of... Yeah, like, in the comics and in the...
He's a little more handsome.
The TV show and stuff. Yeah, like, I imagined him as kind of... He's blue, but I always imagined
yeah.
that he was handsome and kind of like...
Well, he does have, like, vampire teeth, and he does have weird, like, three-fingered claw hands and stuff.
Yeah. But, like, in the movie, the way they, I don't know, they give him kind of, like, greasy hair and these, like, big, like, unkempt, like, fingernails. Yeah. You know, like,
it's pretty real, gross.
Yeah, they make him, like, a little more gnarly than
he's
I
he's more monstrous. And he's like that in the X-Men Apocalypse movie, too. He's kind of ugly. And, I mean, you know, they got a good actor. Alan Cummings as Nightcrawler is very good.
Yeah.
And he has a lot of the spirit, seemingly a lot of the spirit in the comic. He at times is a little theatric. He's like, I am the great Nightcrawler. And, like, Wolverine tells him to shut up.
Yeah.
There's that. But he plays it mostly sad, which is kind of realistic for this world. Like, it must be tough to be Nightcrawler in mm-hmm. this world.
Yeah.
In the X-Men comic, you know, when he's first introduced, he's being hunted by, like, villagers in Eastern Europe or in Germany somewhere, and they're going to burn him at the stake. And so he is, like, persecuted.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as he joins the X-Men and he's accepted, he's very much, like, happy-go-lucky. And
right,
likes
he,
to
like,
drink,
finds his confidence.
Like, Wolverine's his best friend. They like to drink beer together. He's
yeah.
always making jokes.
Right.
And stuff like that. And he's, like, a real adventurer.
I mean, I guess in this movie they just found him, so he hasn't, like, found that
yeah.
confidence yet.
Yeah.
But he really plays it as, like, shy and...
Sad.
Sad and, like, yeah, like, hunted.
Yeah, so that's so it's an element.
Yeah.
It's just it's and we don't see him again in Alan Cumming as the actor. He doesn't come back.
Yeah, it's too bad.
So it's you know it's kind of a shame because Nightcrawler to me Nightcrawler is like a key X-Man.
He's like one of my top favorite X-Men.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
I know I always talk about my love for Rogue, but like he's definitely like I would say one of my like top three.
The power's great.
Too.
The look is great. I love his red and black costume.
But
with
also
the white
because
gloves.
There's so much like character evolution for him. Like
yeah.
I feel like that's kind of lost potential that they didn't continue with Alan Cummings in the subsequent movies.
One of my favorite X-Men comics ever from all time. It's like right after the Dark Phoenix saga where Jean's dead. They meet, like, Nightcrawler dies. He, like, it's his birthday. It's his 21st birthday or something, and he gets a birthday present out of nowhere, and he just opens it up in the X-Mansion, and it explodes in his face, and he's dead.
Mm.
And so it's really sad, and they call in Doctor Strange to see what's up, and Doctor Strange's like, he's not dead. He's only mystically dead. And then they have to travel into the seven circles of hell to find him, because that's where he says his soul is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great episode, comic,
yeah.
where it's with Doctor Strange and Storm and Wolverine and Colossus, they travel to hell to rescue Nightcrawler.
Awesome.
And it turns out not to be the real hell. It's like it's an elaborate illusion.
Right, okay.
It's all about, like, he's meeting his, like, long-lost sister from the circus or something.
Hmm.
So, but anyway, the point is, like, Nightcrawler was great in the comics.
Yeah.
All right. So, it's nice to see him in a movie, I guess, at the very least. And then also what happens in the movie, we see Mystique breaking into some federal building looking for files. She wants to break Magneto out of prison. So she finds some, like, files on the guards, and also she gets some, like, files on what Stryker's up to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of an interesting scene because it reminds you of the best portrayal of Mystique
yeah.
in the movies.
Yeah, Rebecca Romijn is, like, really great as Mystique.
Yeah, and a very, again, a very dialogue less role. She only has a few lines. In the first movie, she had, like, one line. In
right.
this movie, she has a couple of scenes.
Right. She's very... Well, she's subdued in her dialogue, but not in her actions. She,
no.
like, actually is, like, a real driver for the action of this movie.
Yeah. Her facial expressions are great.
It doesn't really make sense that they don't give her, like, more of a speaking role, though.
They give her more, though, in this one. She speaks a few times. Like, she speaks as her character. When she speaks, her voice is weirdly modulated, which is an effect I always like on characters.
well, when used appropriately, and I think for
right.
her it is appropriate.
Yeah, there's something weird, like an alien about her natural speaking voice that they capture, that put a modulation on it. And also, she's got great stage presence. Even, you know, it's a shame that she had to, like, be naked for the filming of it, which to me makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I guess visually it looks kind of cool, but it's like Mystique in the comics wore a dress, you know?
Right,
you
yeah.
could give her some kind of, like, updated, like, sexy dress.
You wouldn't even have to update it. Her dress is awesome in the comics.
I agree. I
know?
Think it would work in the movies,
that
too.
That white dress with the skulls or whatever.
That's
what,
but
the
you can
skull
just,
belt. It's, like,
you can make it a little bit
awesome.
More, like, modern and tasteful. Like, a white dress of some kind.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
Right. So, and she also, she has a scene as her real self, too, later. We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
So that was good. That was nice of them to let her play. And that's kind of like that one scene was the premise they needed to have Jennifer Lawrence constantly transition back to the blonde human version.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And I don't know. So, like, we've all expressed our displeasure at Jennifer Lawrence's role as Mystique. And it's really not even her fault. It's just that, like, she was too big of a movie star.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to make Mystique a major character. And
yeah.
that, like, made no sense.
I think it's a similar thing, again, going back to Hugh Jackman. It's like, was made a star with that movie, and then because...
So Wolverine has to be the center of attention.
Right, because he became such a big star. And I think for her, too, like, that movie made her a star, and then because she was a star, they had to keep putting her in the spotlight of the movies.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, she also did Hunger Games around that time, too, so that really made her a star.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, Hugh Jackman, it's like a little bit of the chicken and the egg thing, because, like, one hand, he's great as Wolverine, mm-hmm. but on the other hand, Wolverine is one of the top characters in all of Marvel's universe.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's like, you can't blame the movie makers for making him the center of attention, really. But in the X-Men world, he shouldn't really be the focus.
Right.
He's a great, like he's like a 1B character. Mm-hmm. Like, I guess Professor X would be 1A. I don't know. And then it's debatable who the next guy is. If it is Wolverine or if it's Cyclops or Jean. Mm-hmm. It's one of those three, really. They're like the heart and soul. So, and Storm, you know.
Yeah, but, well, see, but that's the thing, is that, like, it should be a little more equal.
Yeah, a little more equal. Not, like, not diminish Wolverine, but make it, like, more equal.
That's, like, one of the strengths of the X-Men franchise, I think, when you're comparing, like, the X-Men movies to the Spider-Man movies that came out around this time. Like, Tobey Maguire kind of had to carry those movies, and, like, you know, it's fine, and Spider-Man's a great character, and, like, the movies were, like, good in kind of similar ways
but
to this.
It makes sense, because it's Spider-Man. He's singular.
Right, totally. But I'm saying, like, I think that adds a lot of, like, potential and interest to X-Men, that you have, like, multiple characters, so you, like, switch focus, and there's a lot of storytelling to be done. I mean, Spider-Man has a lot of great storytelling to be done, too. I don't know why they keep going back to origin stories with him, but
yeah, I know.
Whatever. That's a conversation for a different day.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I agree. Wolverine is a great character, but it should be a little more evenly split.
Well, speaking of Wolverine, after we're introduced to Nightcrawler... Oh, no, we're still talking about Mystique. So, Rebecca Romijn Stamos is great in the role. It's a kind of a shame. She's an actress they could have brought back later in the newer incarnations, because if she's slathered in blue makeup all the time,
yeah,
you know, you could really hide her aging, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Not that it would be a shame to show a more middle-aged woman, but you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah. To make the timelines make sense with the movies.
Right.
Yeah.
Alright, so that's Rebecca Romijn. Oh, what I wanted to mention, so in that scene when she's breaking the files, you get a lot of, like, neat little X-Men Easter eggs. Like, you see, as she's going through the computer database, you see Remy LeBeau, which was exciting at the time. It's like, oh my god, Gambit.
Yeah.
And then when they actually gave us Gambit, it was terrible. Yeah, well. And then you see, like, other weird stuff, like Franklin Richards, there's a file on him, who's the son of Reed and Sue Storm.
Right.
Well, Reed Richards and Sue Storm of the Fantastic Four, and he's a mutant, and so that's kind of weird that they show him. And there's some, like, other, like, little Easter eggs in there, too. I didn't catch them all. At this point, like, those Easter eggs are so dated, and we've gotten so many movies since then that it doesn't matter. They've lost their power as anything meaningful.
Yeah.
But still sort of worth noting, because when you first saw the movie, you knew, like, all fans' eyes were scanning to see what they could catch, because you were just desperate for anything. All right, and then we get, like, some more, we're reminded of Wolverine's flashbacks, some more his history, the plot line of his Weapon X program. I really like, there's one scene. So he's, like, trying to sleep in the X-Mansion, and he's flashing back to Weapon X times, and you see more of it than we saw in the last movie. They show him running out of the facility. He's covered in blood, and the claws are out. And I just, like, it's a two-second scene, but he's, like, looking at his hands, and he's like, ah! He's really horrified of what's been done to him.
Yeah.
And it's just great, because he's, like, really covered in blood. And it hints at the Weapon X comic, which we never get to see in a satisfying way in these movies. Because the Weapon X... I mean, Wolverine Origins movies, which shows the Weapon X story, is fucking terrible. But then Logan is really bloody and violent. But that's what the Weapon X Origin Wolverine movie should have been. Mm. Him, like, hacking and slashing everyone. So this movie actually hints at, like, what a good movie would be of Weapon X. Mm-hmm. If ever so briefly.
Yeah.
And that's, like... It's cool to see how they, like, were doing a good job, like, building up that, like, whole secret story of Wolverine's and his mysterious origin. All right, next, we get the, that's also when we meet, so he wakes up from his nightmare, and he meets the kid who blinks and changes the channels, like, that's his only superpower.
That can't be his only power, though.
Well, he also says he can't sleep, he doesn't sleep either.
That's kind of a superpower in itself. You have 8 extra hours in your day, like, imagine how many things you could get done.
Well, he's just filling his time watching television that whole time.
Yeah, but he, you know.
No, but you're right, I'm just making a joke. Awesome. That's funny. Okay. And then, you know, he has, like, a heart-to-heart with Iceman, where Iceman's expressing his anxiety about dating Rogue, how he can't touch her. And mm-hmm. kind of like an awkward scene. But I do like when Iceman blows in Wolverine's coke and it ices over.
Yeah.
That was a neat effect. It's like I like seeing the ancillary Iceman powers sometimes.
I like seeing all the ancillary powers
yeah.
that like any mutant has.
That's
like,
true. Yeah.
Little details that like you don't think about, but then it makes you imagine what it's like to really be a mutant. And it's like, oh yeah, you like live with that all the time. So you probably like find all these extra little things that you could do.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm not someone who wants to see movies about the teenage X-Men or the teenagers in the schools and stuff. And I know we're watching The Gifted Show, which is about younger runaway mutants too, in a sense. And that's kind of okay. But, and I hated that X-Men Evolution show about X-Men in high school, whatever. But if I had to say that there is a lot you could do worse than doing a movie about what it's like to be in Xavier's school.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a great show or movie. Mainly because, like, imagine, like, to me, Iceman has amazingly cool powers.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a really, you know, he's a young, good-looking guy. So you'd imagine him being really popular.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, like, the kid who, like, looks, has, like, a blue tongue and kind of sucks. And there's, like, to me, there's, like, storytelling there. It's, like, some mutants are, like, real, like, awesome, almost, like, celebrities in the school. And they have a lot of potential, and you can tell their future. They're going to be groomed to be future X-Men, whereas other ones are kind of lame, and they might not have much of a future, and they just have to live with being the freak of being a mutant.
You never know, because I think it's the same. It's, I mean, the whole thing, of course, is like an allegory for what it's like to be like a teenager without mutant powers,
but,
right?
Yeah, but I like that, like that division that you could show in a mutant high school, where some kids they not only look good but they have great powers, and other kids are like not as good looking and they have like crappy powers.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that like just because a lot of it, especially when you're a teenager, I think is about how you carry yourself, and that's not really a lesson that that a lot of people learn until like later on in life when
right.
you like develop confidence, but like confidence is a big part of it, right? So like the kid who can like blink and change channels or something, like we only see him use his power in that one way, so we're like whatever, like not a big deal, he's not going to be a future X-Man. But you don't know, like that kid could have like tons of self-confidence and be super charismatic and like get groomed by Professor X
right.
and maybe it turns out that his powers are actually like energy disruption that's super useful in some other way. You know what
I'm
saying?
I mean, like, it seems like a lot of them are going to be future teachers at the school, especially with the ones with crappy powers, because right now he's only got Storm Jean and Cyclops and
uh-huh.
they spend most of their time teaching. So it'll be nice when they can... When these kids get a little older and they have nothing else to do, they can't join the X-Men, but they can help other mutants, you know, learn.
I'm saying I think any of those kids could join the X-Men if their disposition was correct. Look at Toad.
No, the X-Men are... Toad's got powers that are useful. Toad can jump really high and has a tongue that could, like, open doors from across the room.
Yeah, all right,
I guess.
Can strip poison. I always, like, looked at him as, like...
I know, he's lame. I agree. But that's what I'm saying. There's all these, like, levels to it. Like, that's a show about, like, where there's commentary amongst... meta-commentary amongst the characters in the school.
Uh-huh.
Where they talk about, it's like, oh, like... Well, of course, Iceman is, like, the coolest because he, you know, can turn himself into ice and he's got all these useful powers where all I can do is, like... I can turn my, like, hands, like, red and green whenever I want, and that's it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess I'm going to be the janitor here. And that's how they treat me, kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just saying there's, like, a lot of narrative potential and, like, comedy and also drama for an X-Men high school show.
Hmm.
Told with a sort of sardonic outlook.
Sounds like an open discussion for, like, a racism, classism sort of.
Yeah, like, yeah. Like within the mutant school walls, there's like all, there must be all this tension.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's like the heart of the X-Men. It's a soap opera. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's so intricate. Okay. So now begins like another major set piece of the movie, the paramilitary invasion of the X-Mansion. Great scene.
Mm-hmm.
The Strikers forces, you know, arrive in their helicopters and their jeeps, and they're invading the mansion. They're shooting all the kids with, like, drug guns
mm-hmm.
to knock them out. And it's pretty, like, sad and fucked up in a
tranquilizers,
way.
Tranquilizers, no?
Yeah, drug guns. They're shooting them all with drug gun tranquilizers, and it's pretty sad. you know, this is like Professor X's and Magneto's worst nightmare.
Yeah.
That the government just, they're going to hunt children.
Right.
You know, law-abiding kids that are just born a certain way.
Uh-huh. And, the future X-Men.
Yeah. And but we get a lot of cameos. We see Kitty Pryde fall through her bed. She escapes. Like, some of the mutants are more capable than others, as we see, you know.
Yeah.
And then there's another mutant called Siren, who I think is related to Banshee somehow, because
mm-hmm.
she's got the same power. She can scream really loud and mm-hmm. drive everyone crazy with her noise.
We see Colossus metal up.
Oh, yeah, Colossus.
That's,
yeah.
like, a big shame. I wish he was... Yeah. I mean, he's an adult in this movie. I wish he was part of the fighting team.
Yeah, it's more of him. At least when the scene where he turns to Wolverine and they're rescuing all the kids, he's like, I can help you. And Wolverine's like, help them.
Yeah.
Which Wolverine's like, all right, let's help me for 5 minutes.
Yeah, come on over.
And then they beat up, like, a bunch of dudes together.
Yeah.
That might have been something cut for budgetary reasons, who knows.
But, oh, yeah, that's true.
But that guy, the actor who plays him, I forget his name, he comes back in X3. He also comes back in X-Men Days of Future Past 2. So he gets time to be Colossus again. But then, not weirdly, they get a new Colossus for the Deadpool movie,
mm-hmm.
who's entirely CGI.
Yeah.
And is much more like the comic Colossus in the sense that, first of all, he's got a Russian accent.
Right.
Unlike the guy in this movie. And he's, like, a little more comic booky,
mm-hmm.
talking about being a do-gooder and stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, I always told you, Deadpool, you must remember to eat your vegetables. You know, like, something like that. That was more of a Dracula accent, but still, you get the idea. So then it's like, you know, we get the scene where Wolverine, like, goes crazy with his claws, like, stabbing and slicing a bunch of guys. But because it's a PG-13 movie, there's no blood. Which is not to say there's no blood in this movie. We see some blood later on. We saw some blood earlier with Wolverine's flashback, not from having stabbed anyone that we saw, but like it is kind of disconcerting, especially after having seen Logan, that when you see him stab somebody and there's no blood gushing out of like 6 puncture marks in someone's chest. It's not like that. It's kind of just distracting in a weird way. And that's the big fear with these Disney movies, that we're going to get back to that when they, you know, because they can't do Logan, I don't think.
No.
Unless they do another solo Wolverine movie and decide to rate it R, but it's going to be so hard to imagine Disney wanting to do that, especially with Wolverine's going to be a major character. They're going to want to cross over into Avengers and all this stuff.
It honestly doesn't bother me that much that you don't see, like, blood gushing in this scene that you're talking about. We get, like, gory scenes later and before this, so, like, I'm not really sure why we don't see blood in this one. Because
it's too violent. I mean, you saw Logan. It's insane. Like, he chops off someone's head, and the blood bursts out.
But it's not even that. It's, like, in the other scenes in this movie where we, like, see the flashback to Wolverine getting his claws and stuff like that. Like, it's bloody. Like, it's pretty gory.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm not really certain why that's in some scenes and not others in this movie.
And we see later,
like,
Magneto, when he escapes from jail, he extracts the iron from that guy's blood.
Yeah.
That Mystique pumped into him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's blood. You see all the blood in his chest.
Yeah.
And that's kind of gross.
I don't know. It doesn't really make a difference to me. Like, you understand that this guy has been stabbed in the chest 6 times simultaneously. Like,
later
it's bad.
Yeah, it's bad. And later in the fight between Wolverine and Lady Deathstrike, when they're slashing each other, there's some traces of blood sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, it's like you get the idea because they're both wearing dark black leather outfits that the blood's kind of... You can't really see it because it's in a dark place, too.
But that scene still is, like, super gory, even without seeing all the blood.
Yeah, I agree. So, but that's fine. You're right. I agree with you with that. That scene doesn't bother me, and I think it's great. This scene with the guys wearing, like, gray outfits, and then he stabs them, and you don't see anything, that's, like, a little distracting to me, that there's no blood. But it's fine. Yeah. It's a kid's movie, you know.
He's stabbed, whatever. Yeah,
that's true. Right. All right, so, you know, Wolverine saving the day. We see Iceman, like, make a really cool ice wall between Wolverine and Stryker.
Mm-hmm.
That, I always liked that scene. That was a magical moment.
Yeah.
Iceman. Everyone's a little bit stunned by it. That ice wall, like, you just want to lick it, you know?
Stryker, like, touches it in wonder.
And it's, like, already starting to melt, and it's a little gooey when he touches it. It's just really great touch. So, again, the potential of Iceman, but not really the full payoff we really want. They escape in the car where, as we mentioned before, it's Cyclops' car, and I guess Cyclops listens to NSYNC or something, which is a burn on Cyclops. And also a big burn on NSYNC. It must have been sad for NSYNC when they're like, oh, X-Men 2 wants to feature in music. Okay. And then it turns out it's just to, like, goof on it.
Yeah.
You know, because all the characters, like, scrunch up their faces and turn it off right away. So, you know, that's a scene that always sticks out. And then we get the scene where finally Rebecca Romijn Stamos gets to play herself in, like, a weird blue leather dress.
Which snakeskin.
I like that dress. Yeah, because it's like her outfit, but in dress form.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's a really beautiful woman, and on the screen in the background is Dr. Hank McCoy in human form, which is interesting as a cameo. I think he was supposed to have a larger role, but he was written out of the movie. He comes back. He comes in X-Men 3, but not as the same actor as Kelsey Grammer in X-Men 3. So we see him. And then, you know, also what's going – while this is happening – Professor X is visiting Magneto in the plastic prison, but that was all set up by Stryker. He gasses Professor X and Magneto, and Cyclops is taken out of the action by Lady Deathstrike. And this is like the one fight scene, major fight scene we get to see Cyclops in this movie. I mean, he comes in the end a little bit too, but we get to see him. He knows karate, which is true to the character. He takes down those four guards without any problem, and he's like blasting people. But then Lady Deathstrike quickly knocks him out of the movie, and it's kind of a shame. And it's also, it makes sense that Professor X is kind of taken out of the action too, because that's, like we've discussed many times, that's the trope of X-Men movies, that Professor X has to be removed because he's too powerful. He can't have it. He would just stop everyone's brain in a second. So he's knocked out of the action. And then we get to another major set piece in the movie. On the road, Rogue, Pyro, Iceman, and Wolverine end up at Iceman's house to, like, to huddle for a second. They're trying to contact Jean and Storm and the Blackbird, but they're having trouble with the strange X-Man phone they have. It's not really working, and we get the whole coming out scene. So actually, before that, they're in Bobby Drake, Iceman, his like childhood room, and him and Rogue decide to make out for the first time. Excuse me. And it's funny because they kiss, and they actually are able to kiss for like a good like 2 seconds. She's fine.
Right, she just like breathes cold air for a minute.
Yeah, and do you think that's because that was from him, or because she absorbed his power a little bit?
Oh, I thought it was because she absorbed his power a little bit.
It's not because like he just blew into him, blew into her sort of, and he's so frosty on the inside.
Oh, maybe, I don't know.
I don't know either. But anyway, they kiss again, and then he doesn't like it because she starts to suck away his life force.
Right,
and so it's a big problem for him. But they do establish that they can kiss for like 1 to 2 seconds. So that to me. If I was...
That's promising, huh?
That, yeah, it's progress. you know, it's something. I mean, I don't want to get too crude here, but they could have sex. This is what you do. you put her in some yoga pants, as Rogue would be wearing in the cartoon and comic book anyway. You cut a hole in there. And he's wearing his
pants. A unitard. She just needs a unitard.
Yeah. He's wearing protection, for one. And also he's wearing some yoga pants, I guess. You know, so he can be a little little more skin to skin in a way. And then that's it. I mean, like, I think as long as rubber blocks her power, then they could be intimate. You know? It wouldn't be totally satisfying.
Kiss for, like, a minute, you know, a couple seconds at a time.
Yeah. I think they could make it work. That's what I would be – and every boy is probably – and probably girl too is thinking about how they could get this to work. So it's not impossible. So I mean the romance
– they're figuring it out.
Well, no. They would have figured it out way faster. A 7-year-old kid who's got a really hot girlfriend would like – that would immediately spring to his mind. He would be – become Einstein. Quit, no matter how stupid he was, he'd figure out a way to get this to work. I mean, my real theory is that, like, in the cartoon, anyway, you get the mutant collars and you put one on Rogue when you're ready to have sex. You know, that's what Gambit should do. Anyway, so then it's the whole coming out scene. Iceman's parents come home. They are shocked to see Wolverine there in their house. And Iceman has to reveal to his parents that he's a mutant. And they're kind of shocked and dismayed. And her mother says, "Have you ever tried to stop being mutant?" Which is like a clear allegory to what gay people go through with their parents often. You know, Bryan Singer, a gay man himself, like put a lot of that, his personal story, into the movie in many ways. You know, I don't want to talk about Bryan Singer and his like complete like implosion as a popular figure in the world.
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about?
Not really.
All right, I will talk about that.
All right.
So, I mean, he... you know, there's been some hints and allegations throughout the years that he was inappropriate with some young, like, actors trying to make it, and younger than what is appropriately young, like 17 years old or 16, I think 17 is the age.
Okay.
That he carried on affairs with 17-year-olds, or he allegedly assaulted or raped them, maybe, even. Who knows? I mean, he's always denied the allegations. I don't know what to believe there. I don't really care. Not that I don't care about people being raped or sexually assaulted, but I don't... like care enough about Bryan Singer to know all the details.
Got it.
And then recently he was directing the Queen movie, and he got fired from it because he had some kind of emotional meltdown on the set, and or he was like skipping out of work a lot. And but no one could tell because there was new allegations that arose at the same time. So maybe Fox just used it as a convenient excuse to fire him. And he's been kind of like kicked out of the Fox universe because he had a real, you know, he's really tied in with the X-Men. He's like an executive producer on the TV shows like Gifted and Legion. He's an executive producer on all the new movies and he directs them. And, you know, it's just like he's really fallen from grace quickly here. And, you know, I'm not going to say it's a shame because if he's guilty of what he's allegedly been accused of, then, you know, it's a privilege to work in Hollywood and make millions of dollars. And if you're, a freaking rapist, like, fuck you, you know. At the same time, it's all alleged, and who really knows what the truth is. And, you know, like I said, I don't really
care. Is
this
stuff that came out, like, with Harvey Weinstein and all the
It's tied up with it. Yeah, or, it's been in the same, like, news media cycle.
Okay.
But I think the rumors about Singer have been out longer than even the Harvey Weinstein. Well, definitely out longer than the Harvey Weinstein being fully outed. The Harvey Weinstein rumors have also been around for years, too.
Right.
But, like I said, the only reason I don't want to talk about it is, like, I just don't care enough about Bryan Singer. It's not like I'm so passionate about him as a artist
that you're not willing to rush to his defense.
I'm not willing to rush to his defense, nor am I willing to destroy him and say, "Oh, this fucking asshole! I can't believe he directed X-Men." You know, I just think it's like one of these like weird situations.
Yeah. Okay. Well, now we've talked about it.
Yeah, we've talked about it, right. So I think it was just worth mentioning. Like, you know, can't like talk about the X-Men movies without mentioning Bryan Singer in some way. All right. So so he's coming out to his parents, and I never liked the scene, not because I don't think it's like clever to associate X-Men with the gay experience. I think it is very applicable because, like, being gay, you know, it doesn't affect. It's not like racism, where it's against one particular race if you're racist, let's say, right, or against all races that aren't your race. It's like homosexuality is across all races and all genders, so. That's similar to being a mutant. It's not like there's mutant. Being a mutant is not limited to nationality or sexual identity or gender. So it's like anyone could be a mutant, and you would have to come out in a way similar to like a homosexual coming out to their parents. So I get it, like, and it's clever, but it just I just didn't like the scene. I've never liked the scene, and I'll tell you why. Now that I think of it, I've never really thought about it till a second. The reason is because the acting. I hate the acting of the parents. I think they're really annoying to look at. And I hate his little brother that turns out to be some, like, alt-right little goon that calls the police on them. That makes no sense. I guess he's afraid, but still, he's, like, an alt...
I thought it was more, like, a jealousy issue. Because it's, like, Bobby is, like, telling his parents, like, listen, I'm a mutant, you know? And it's, like, his parents are so shocked and dismayed. And, like, the look on his brother's face to me read, like... Bobby gets all the attention. Why does Bobby get all the attention?
And then I'm going to call police on him?
Like, that type of thing.
I think jealousy's mixed in there, but I think it's mainly he's afraid. He's probably just, like, another, like, idiot, like, at home watching the news and who's afraid of mutants.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
And,
or a cross.
He thinks this is his duty to, like, arrest these people. But the other thing is they subtly imply that Wolverine, before in the previous scene, has his claws out with the cat. The cat was licking his claws. He puts them away quickly when the parents come in, but the son sees it. Bobby's brother does see the claws.
Yeah.
So that it probably is enough motivation for him to be a little bit more afraid than his parents are in this moment. But still, I hate the kid. I hate the kid actor. I hate the parents. It's just crappy acting all around. I don't like Anna Paquin that much. And I don't like Sean Ashmore.
Yeah.
So, and I think Hugh Jackman's acting is also not great in these scenes either. He doesn't mix in with these actors that well either. So, and it's a, like, it's in the middle of a beautiful day, and it's just kind of like a crappily, like...
I think, isn't that the point? Is, like, the contrast of it?
Probably,
like,
but I just don't...
personality versus these, like, very normal suburban people.
Yeah, you're right. Know? Yeah, that's the point of it. But I just don't like it. And then, so then the police come, and I think this is, like, an insane scene where Pyro... Well, first they shoot Wolverine in the head, which is, again, only to establish that he's invincible. It's not really anything else other than that. But it's also establishing that the cops really Like, this is actually kind of interesting, because the cops are really racist against mutants, or bigoted against them.
Well, they're really afraid.
Right, yeah.
And they should be really afraid.
But you could say they're really afraid of black people, too, in the real universe, because they're just shooting them, you know, like, with happy trigger fingers.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So, like, that, in a sense, is really good social commentary there. They're just a shoot Wolverine in the fucking head.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they're ready to, like, maybe kill these other... They're, like, breaking down the windows of this residential home. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's not the way you handle a hostage situation.
Right.
If that's what it is. Just, like, you don't barrel in with a billy club. You have to make sure there's no explosives or there's not other mutants hiding in there that could blow the place up. So the cops, I think, are doing an awful job. And then Pyro, like... is insane in the way he deals with them. He just starts... He says, you know those mutants you hear on the news? Well, I'm the worst one. Which, first of all, I think is debatable, too, that he considers himself the worst one.
Yeah.
There's worse mutants than him.
Yeah, but he's... What is he, 17? And he's, like...
he just really thinks highly of himself.
An inflated ego, yeah.
Yeah, so he starts blowing them all up with fireballs. And I read on Wikipedia that two stuntmen almost died making that scene, which is really sad.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm not sure, like, how or what context, if they're either being burned or if they're just being knocked around... But that's insane. Because it is a very violent scene, the way he's just blowing up the police cars and, like, hurling fireballs at police officers and probably killing a few of them.
Yeah.
And then I always thought in the movies watching that Iceman would be the one to put the fires out.
Right.
And, like, knock his friend out. But it's Rogue who absorbs Pyro's power and just sucks away the fire.
Mm-hmm.
I also thought Rogue could have absorbed Iceman's power and, like...
Well, but she, like...
doesn't want to hurt her friend.
Oh, I thought it was, like, a double effort. Like, she's stopping Pyro and putting out the fire at the same time.
She is. Because she...
You know what I'm saying? Like, it's more useful for her to absorb Pyro's power. Yeah.
But it's just weird with Iceman standing there that he's not using his ice power.
Helping.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could maybe argue that he, like, doesn't want to use his powers in front of his family because...
He's also probably afraid of the police.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's vulnerable. He can just be shot in the head, too, like Wolverine.
Right, yeah. Well, but so can Pyro, so that's what makes it, like, extra crazy that he decides to, like, go for it at that moment.
Another great scene is Magneto escaping from jail.
Mm.
Like we said, the prison guard was injected with the iron from Rebecca Romijn's Stamos.
Mm-hmm.
And so Magneto senses it and, like, violently rips it from his chest.
Right.
And you see, like, a poof of, like, red blood and stuff. So do you think that guy's dead?
Yeah,
he's dead, right? That would kill somebody.
Yeah. I think that's, like, a billion little, like, micro bullets getting pulled through his body.
But it was, like, a fine mist of bullets.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. It'd probably kill him. And then it's cool because he shapes them into three balls, and he uses one ball to make as a floating platform,
mm-hmm.
and the two other balls fly around him like a... Like an atom.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's the atom and these are the electrons.
Yeah, so he, like, floats across that empty space.
That's great imagery.
It's, like, so weird how he, like, crosses his arms in some, like an I Dream of Genie type of pose almost as he's, like, floating across.
Yeah.
It's strange.
And then after the police, Wolverine's fine and everyone's fine. The Blackbird picks up the Wolverine and his merry band of young friends and they fly away. But... It's kind of funny because now the jets have been scrambled against the Blackbird, which I guess is in most cases is in stealth mode. But now someone must have reported it, or the police said, a jet has landed in suburban Boston. So the military's like, you know, got some jets going after them, which to me it reminded me of like Grand Theft Auto. If you commit enough crimes, you get like a 10-star police rating and they send the U.S. like army after you after you've blown up enough police officers with bazookas and things.
Hmm.
So the X-Men are in a similar situation or... The U.S. military has been scrambled to stop them. And this is a pretty cool scene, I think, when they're trying to get away.
Yeah.
Because first storm generates a whole bunch of violent tornadoes.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's awesome, but it's like, are those tornadoes striking down on the ground, too? Are they, like, screwing up? Are they reaching the lower part of the atmosphere? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. She might be causing a lot of collateral damage herself. So she stops one missile and one plane, and then... Oh, no, she stops one plane, and then the other guy manages to shoot missiles through the tornadoes, and Jean stops one of them with her telekinesis,
mm-hmm.
but the other one she can't stop, and it blows up the back of the Blackbird jet. Excuse me. And Rogue goes flying out because she couldn't get her seatbelt on, and that's a really dramatic, screwed-up moment. And Nightcrawler, though, luckily is on board, and he's able to teleport and save her in an act of heroism.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a funny line in there, too, after all the like flying around and flying in circles, where Storm asks, or Jean asks them, like, are you okay back there? And Jackson's like, no. He looks visibly nauseous. It's pretty funny. I just love all the scenes in The Blackbird. I think that's, like, a real great natural setting for X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a cheap way to save on money, too. It's a small set with a bunch of blinking lights.
Right.
And, but, like, I like seeing the X-Men on the Blackbird. But then here's a major plot hole of the movie. The Blackbird's crashing down because it's been blown up in the back. And it's, like, hurtling towards the ground. And out of nowhere, Magneto catches it and saves them.
Right.
Which makes no sense. How
how would he be tracking them? How would he just show up in the middle of nowhere?
How would he
catch
know where
it?
They are? Yeah, like what direction they're flying.
Yeah.
I mean, and they're also in like a dog fight, so they're probably changing direction.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's like so infinitesimal. It's like, it's kind of like when Luke like crashes into Dagobah and like crashes within 2 meters of Yoda.
Yeah, but that's the
and
force,
a whole planet.
Right?
Yeah, I guess. But still, you know what I'm saying.
In X-Men, there's no force.
Well, there's Magneto's force.
Uh-huh.
So, right, who knows?
Yeah.
So that's,
anyway,
that's convenient, yeah. So then there's the whole scene of Magneto, Mystique, and the other X-Men in the woods. They're united, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And Magneto's explaining Stryker's plot and that Professor X is captured and they have to rescue everyone at Alkali Lake. And I guess everyone's camping now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a scene between Jean and Wolverine where Wolverine, like, just makes out with her.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she explains that, you know, I fell in love with Cyclops. He's the good guy. He's like, I could be the good guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then he kind of grabs her and kisses her.
Right.
And do you
thereby
think,
not being the good guy.
Right. Do you think that crosses the line?
I don't know. It's like, it's tricky because Jean, like, also is interested in him.
But it's so weird because Jean's deeply in love and loyal to Cyclops.
Yeah.
But if, like, it'd be really heartbreaking if your loved one told you, like, I made out with somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, that is cheating, especially in that level of a committed relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That's straight up cheating. I mean, even if, like, you were grabbed, but you could always, I mean, she could always say to him if she's ever wanted to be honest, like, listen, he grabbed me and kissed me, but I pushed him away. And she does, and she freezes him.
Yeah.
But at the same time, she was, like, kissing him back a little bit.
Yeah.
So there's got to be real guilt in her heart.
I don't know.
Chamber of Secrets there.
Is he crossing the line? Like, she's made it clear that, like, even though she likes him, she's not going to pursue any kind of relationship or, like, physical action with him.
Right.
You know? And he just, I don't know, decides to disregard that. So, like, yeah, I guess he is crossing the line.
Yeah.
I don't know.
A little bit. But he's not in a gross, like, sexual assault way. I think more in a daring romantic way.
Right.
And then Mystique notices all this, and she's been sort of infatuated with Wolverine in her own way, and she's kind of lonely herself.
Mm-hmm.
So she breaks into his tent as Jean and starts making out with him.
Mm-hmm.
But then he realizes it's Mystique. He doesn't realize it by smelling her. He realizes it by feeling the time he stabbed her in the first movie.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make sense, because the whole point is that he can tell who Mystique is by smelling her.
Right.
I don't know. Whatever.
He's just blindsided because he, like, thinks that it's Jean.
Yeah.
You know?
He wants it to happen.
Yeah.
But then she turns into Storm and Rogue, and he's not having it. And she's kind of, like, insulted and also kind of, like wounded herself by him rejecting her.
Mm-hmm.
But she's kind of also, like, I don't know. She's not happy about it.
Well, she's kind of a sad character, you know?
Definitely.
And, like, we get this more... We get a lot more backstory on her in subsequent movies,
right?
But, it, like, a big theme
dumber
with
backstory,
her...
backstory,
yeah. Yeah, but, like, a big theme with of her personality is that, like, it's hard for her to be accepted for who she actually is, and to be, like, loved and accepted, you know, at all takes transformation for her. So, like, it's kind of like you're rejecting me as a transformed person, but, like, you wouldn't have me either as who I really am.
Yeah,
like,
it's sad.
Yeah, it is sad.
And then, interspersed here, too, we get some moments. There's a scene with Nightcrawler and Rogue, and a scene with Mystique and Nightcrawler. And all of them in the comics have, like, weird, like, familial relations.
Right.
Like, because Rogue is, like, the weird adopted daughter of Mystique,
mm-hmm.
and also Nightcrawler is... I think the
biological
son. Yeah, the son of Mystique.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's
kind of...
They're
kinda, like...
They hint, it's
sort
some,
of like step-siblings,
yeah,
maybe?
Yeah, some hinty fan service just by having those characters share some scenes,
mm-hmm.
I think. At the very least. You know, what happens next? So then, I guess the X-Men decide they're going to save the day. They're flying to Alkali Lake... there's a brief interaction between Magneto and Pyro on the Blackbird where Magneto tempts him to join the dark side. one of the best lines in the movie. He tells Pyro, he says, "You're a god among insects. Let no one ever tell you otherwise."
Mm-hmm.
And Pyro's really impressed by that line.
Yeah.
Because he
really
feels...
takes the bait.
Yeah, he's like a kid that's been, like, kicked around his whole life, and he, like, for once is getting someone to tell him that he's cool.
Yeah.
So, and then they, you know, they have a cool hologram on the Blackbird, some advanced technology. They plan to attack the base. Everyone's, all the crew of the Starship Enterprise is there to save Captain Picard. And William Riker as Cyclops. You know, the plan is that Mystique breaks in, because she's the best for this kind of thing. She breaks in as Wolverine, but then her deception is quickly uncovered by Stryker, and we get to see some awesome Mystique moments of her kicking ass and sliding around on her naked butt, like, through a door that's closing and giving the middle finger, which is, a great iconic scene in the movie. That's an excellent scene.
Mm-hmm.
Mystique, secret all-star of this movie, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Really expanded upon her minor role in the first one and take it to a new place, all with not much dialogue from her, but really great subtle acting by Rebecca Romijn Stamos, who's seemingly not gotten much other acting roles in her life, which is kind of a shame, because it seems like she might be good. Because I even liked her in the scene where she's, like, a human herself.
Mm-hmm.
She's pretty funny, doing the accent.
Yeah, she's good.
Yeah, she has a lot of stage presence, a lot of screen presence. So, if you're out there, Rebecca Romijn Stamos, or Rebecca Romijn now, she divorced the Stamos.
Right.
We love you. A reference to Stamos and the Beach Boys in the same podcast episode. Hint, hint, to all the weird Beach Boys fans out there and Full House fans. Carrying on. What happens next? So then, you know, the X-Men realize the children are also trapped there too, and Storm finds them when they're breaking into the base, and she says Jubilee.
Yeah, so, Jubilee's down there.
Yeah, so she's one of the mutants captured. She was actually in the movie. There's a deleted scene in the movie where you see her, like, a little bit of her fireworks powers come out of her hand, but that was cut out of the movie. So Jubilee, again, given the short shrift in an X-Men movie, it's almost like a tradition. And again, a different actress than I think in the first movie when she was briefly in it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So Jubilee's amongst the young people, so we care about them. And then everybody split up. Cyclops, well, Jean Grey's with Magneto and Mystique, but then Cyclops attacks him because he's been brainwashed too. And that's a really great scene, Jean versus Cyclops, because he's blasting his eye beams at her at full force, and she's deflecting them and throwing him around. And it's kind of cool just to think that as powerful as Cyclops is, Jean can defeat him.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great scene where he's shooting the optic blast and she's blocking it with her powers. And we also get a hint of, like, the firebirds in her eyes, like she's becoming the Phoenix, or maybe he's tapping into the Phoenix Force to do this. But then by knocking him out or something, she, like, throws him against a wall, and that, like, knocks him back into common sense. And he apologizes and, like, feels so bad that he was attacking her. And they have a nice, like, little, like, reunion moment where they're making out and stuff. I think James Marsden, again, giving his all in a very small part, a real shame that he didn't get to shine in this movie, because this is, like, his last major turn as Cyclops, because he's, you know, very briefly appears in only a few more movies, and it's a shame, because he really, like, does his best acting where you can't even see his eyeballs. We'll talk about that in a minute. I'm just trying to blow through to the end here. This is a long episode, and we've all seen the movie. It's very good. And then, you know, Wolverine gets into the fight with Lady Deathstrike. That's a great fight scene. Lady Deathstrike's claws are wonderfully realized, I think, in the movie. I think they look really convincing, mm-hmm. and they're really scary. I'd hate to be in the same room as her. It's so
creepy.
There's
that other scene where she goes into the plastic prison and you see her fingernails, and they're all, it looks like she has, like, silver nail polish on, but then when she takes out her claws, like, it just extends from the nail polish. It's cool.
It's cool and it's gross.
Yeah.
She's a great little character. And their fight, like, they're really being thrown around on wires and stuff. I feel like it's very influenced by Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon at the time. This, like, weird, like
the
Asian,
Asian fight
karate choreography or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, one of the, like, most awesome, like, knife fight scenes in history, if you think about it.
Yeah.
Just two characters with a lot of blades, multiply stabbing each other multiple times.
Uh-huh. And, like, half a life's experience of, like, owning, like, having those blades attached to their bodies makes them, like, really experts at it.
Yeah, they're really insane fighters, and they both have healing power, too, so they can take multiple stab wounds. And it's just a really gruesome scene where Wolverine's seemingly trapped by her. she's like stabbing a fingernail through his throat and like has a whole bunch of claws up his back.
Yeah.
And then we all know how the fight resolves. Like, she attacks him one more time, and he grabs an adamantium juicing gun and like sticks it into her stomach, mm-hmm. and pumps her full of adamantium, and she's like, her body is like overflowing with this metallic stuff that hardens quickly.
Yeah.
And it's like, first of all, it's burning, because Stryker talks about how hot it has to be kept in order for it to be in liquid form, because mm-hmm. it's an unbreakable metal, in like this fictional metal that exists, this mm-hmm. fictional element adamantium. So it's, imagine like hot, super hot, scalding, burning metal coursing through your body, and your body has the power to heal too, so your body's like trying to fight it but just can't, and then it like comes at her eyeballs and she's like crying adamantium.
Yeah.
And she sinks into the water too, of the water tank.
So heavy.
Yeah.
Metal.
And she's definitely gonna drown to death, so there's no way her mutant power is gonna save her.
I mean,
terrible, sad death.
Again, I just feel like it's a shame that she could be a robot for all intents and purposes,
right.
in this movie. She's given no personality, no backstory. She's completely two-dimensional, and I think that's a loss for her and Wolverine and the movie.
I like that Wolverine kills her in the most badass way possible, like by doing that, but he does feel regret by doing it too.
Yeah.
Because he sees her in himself like she's another like mutant who's experimented on. And
right, another victim of Stryker.
Stryker, yeah. So that's actually really sad that he has to kill her. He couldn't find a way to save her. In fact, you're right. They should have, like, if this was a better movie, he would have found a way to save her. She would have gotten away, because then they could have explored, like, because he doesn't have his memories and they're supposed
right.
to have dated.
Like, even if they can't, like, devote the time to that, because that, you know, if they're going to fully go into it, it would take a while. So, like, even if they don't have the time for it, they don't want to shoehorn it into this movie, fine, but, like, leave it as a possibility for another time. Because...
And it's just a great character. She really worked in the movie. Like, visually, it was amazing to see Yuriko or Lady Deathstrike come to life.
Yeah.
It's, like, incredible. Because I really hate the look of her in the comic books.
Mm-hmm.
In the movie, she looked great. All right, so that's what's going on there. And then, meanwhile, Magneto's doing the ultimate twist, which is really clever, like one of the best aspects of the movie. So Stryker's plan was to have Professor X be brainwashed by his son Jason to kill all the mutants using Cerebro by concentrating really hard, the crossing the streams moment.
Mm-hmm.
And conversely, Magneto breaks in. He saves all the mutants who are all dying. It's like when the effect is in full force, it's like everyone's getting the worst migraine ever, like a paralyzing like brain aneurysm. So he reverses it. He flies the panels around. Like, somehow he knows how to do this. I mean, I know he said he helped Professor X build Cerebro.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it makes no sense that he would know how to, like, move all these, like, unmarked panels around to reconfigure the device towards humans.
Mm-hmm.
So he does that. So then he has Professor X, through Jason, order him to kill all the humans in the world. Which is a really fucked up and awesome twist ending. Because it reminds you that Magneto's evil, that he's got his own agenda,
yeah.
and that he's not, like, the good guy in this movie.
Right.
Despite, because they really do make you feel sympathetic for him for a large part of it.
Yeah.
So that's a great twist. And then, you know, for some reason, Storm has to be the one to go into this room. She has Nightcrawler teleport him inside. And it's kind of like, speaking about crossing the streams, it reminds me of the end of Ghostbusters, where she's in this room, she only sees this little girl who is the persona of Jason.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, Professor, if you're in here, you have to stop this right now. You're being used by Cerebro. And just the way she's announcing it to, like, an empty void, it's this little girl. It reminded me of Ray Stantz confronting Gozer. He's like, Gozer the Gozerian? I demand you to return to the nearest parallel dimension at your earliest convenience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's awkward, you know?
Yeah, it is. And the girl's just, like, laughing. It's like, I've got you now. But so Storm freezes out the room. She manages to save all the humans in doing so. Professor X takes off his Cerebro helmet. The world is saved. Although, just imagine all the people that were on airplanes that must have crashed into the mountains by all the pilots, and all the, like, people driving cars that drove off the cliffs or smashed into buildings, and all the other people who were, like, the pain is so excruciating that they must have jumped out of windows and killed themselves. And then also thinking about all the pain, like, all the babies and children in the world felt. It's, like, a horrifying, like, 5 minutes of torture for the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, serious consequences.
Well, planes have autopilot, and maybe all the drivers stopped driving at the same time,
maybe.
So the roads just stood still, and, you know.
We can only hope. But it seems like the collateral damage of this move that Magneto sent to motion.
Yeah, right.
So the day is relatively saved. They all have to escape this alkali lake that is blowing up because when Cyclops' optic beam in a really cool scene when Jean, like, reversed it on him, like, blew back and blew up the whole facility.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really cool scene because you see the red envelop the entire, like, area, and that's like a hint at like how like massive Cyclops' powers could be if his eyes were really like blasted open. So the whole base is going to be flooded by this dam. They have to escape. Pyro escapes with Magneto. He decides to join the dark side. They get away. Stryker and Wolverine have some last words in the meantime, and he says, like, you're never going to find your past with the X-Men. And Wolverine kind of, like, stabs him a few times and ties him up to a chain, and, you know, that's the end. That's that with Stryker. He gets flooded. We see the kid with the blue tongue, like, stick his tongue out at Stryker at the end there. And then the X-Men, because Rogue and Iceman had to, like, fly the Blackbird to, like, beat them, they know what they're doing. It kind of crashed into the snow, so it's stuck. And they can't get away from the tidal wave that's going to come and kill them all. So Jean takes it upon herself in the most sacrificial move to... She gets off the plane and stops the flood with her telekinesis, and then also lifts the Blackbird up, too, at the same time. And doing this requires a great amount of concentration from Jean, and it's a self-sacrificial move. It's very sort of controversial for people who like to point out plot holes. It's like, why can't she do that from inside the plane? You know, why does she have to be standing outside?
Yeah. Just to play devil's advocate, it's like, there's two aspects to it, I think.
Yeah.
One is that she maybe needs so much concentration that she can't do it while Cyclops and, like, all her friends are around. Maybe she, like, needs to be isolated so that she can, like, concentrate better. The second thing is, a lot of times when you see Jean use her powers, it's almost like she needs to physically, like, move her hand and, like, look at the thing she's moving in order for it to move. So for her to stand inside the Blackbird and move it might not, like, physically work as well for her.
I mean, obviously, you're right. Like, that's the – that would be the explanation you would give. But still, it makes no sense.
Yeah.
And also, you've got Iceman there. Like, you think he might be able to – like, I know he's young, too. He doesn't really have control of his powers, but – maybe he can build, like, an ice wall or freeze,
like, freeze the water. Yeah.
Also, like, what else could they have done? Like, some of them could fly. Like, maybe Storm could have flown off a few people, and Nightcrawler could have teleported people out of the way.
Or, like, Storm has used, like, her tornado powers and stuff before to, like, help lift a
she
ship could have
helped
out
him.
Of...
She could have lifted Jean up from inside, maybe, the ship with the wind. If she can control the wind from inside the ship on the outside.
But also, Professor, like, X is with them, and he's, like, the most power... Oh, I guess he's, like, supposed to be tired out from all his work with Cerebro,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and right. I don't know what he could do physically.
He can't, like, levitate the Blackbird up and...
But the other thing is, it's, like, the second after Jean's engulfed, it's possible that he could have scanned the ocean real quick to say, like, she's there.
Yeah.
And then someone, Nightcrawler, teleports into the water real quick and fishes her out. And although she might be dead by the wave instantly, at the same time, maybe not. Maybe she's just, because she slowed it down enough that maybe she was just drowning to death. So it's like, I don't know. It's just kind of weird how they leave her behind. And great acting by James Marsden in the scene. He gives it his all, just, like, completely freaking out and crying and, you know, talking to Professor X. Jean's talking through Professor X to Cyclops, saying, like, forget about me, I love you.
Yeah.
And he's just crying, and, like, his facial expressions are amazing, and he's just so in the moment, like, giving it his all. And it's what a waste of an actor. He really would have been the greatest Cyclops ever. And, you know, he's barely used in X-Men 3, and he dies, so we all know. Kind of a shame there. But then the X-Men, they escape, they return to Washington, because now there's huge fallout from this world-changing event where everyone almost died. The president's about to give a speech saying, like, you know, we have to, like, crack down on these mutants, obviously. But they, Professor X uses his weird, like, time dilation powers to freeze the moment, and all the X-Men are in the Oval Office while he's giving a speech, like, quite threateningly in a weird way, even though Professor's like, we're not here to threaten you, but, like, clearly you are.
Yeah.
And they give him the secret documents about William Stryker. And, like, okay, make of this what you will. I feel like that wouldn't work. I feel like the president in that moment, like, they don't show what he decides to do next. But I feel like he would say, okay, well, that was weird. These people are still clearly dangerous. They just broke into the Oval Office again. You know, I don't feel comfortable about these mutants. I don't know. They're kind of crazy. I still think the X-Men would be in a lot of trouble.
Right. I mean, it's supposed to be, like, a show of goodwill from the X-Men, right? Like, we can't force you, or, like, we're not going to try to force you to do anything or whatever, but, like, we want to convince you that we're, like, we're the good guys here and we're on your side.
Yeah. That's the idea,
if
right?
I was Professor X, I would do that moment for show for the other X-Men to show, like, oh, we're, like, trying to convince him, honestly. But secretly, I'd be brainwashing the president in that moment, saying, like, believe us. We are telling you the truth. Do not, like, hunt all the mutants and not tell anyone about it. That's what I would do. You know what I mean?
Every time we've seen Professor X do, like, secret mind melding or whatever, though, it always backfires. So
Maybe it backfired in this movie too, because like he was the one who took Jason into his school originally, and he couldn't help him.
Yeah,
and Jason like ended up killing his own mother by putting illusions in her mind,
right?
That made her want to bore them out with the drill. So whose fault is that? Is that Jason's or Professor X's? It's like, again, Professor X, bad therapist. William Stryker kind of justified in being very angry here.
Yeah. And did we mention that you see, like, the ocean where Jean...
That's how it ends, so it ends, Jean Grey's giving the speech about mutation, and, like, we're, like, the camera's hovering over Alkali Lake, and we see, like, what might be a phoenix bird underneath the water.
A shadow of a phoenix.
And that's, like, a great ending, because you're like, oh, the Phoenix saga's coming up next, gonna be fucking awesome.
As a fan, you're, like, super excited.
Yeah, because this movie was really good, like we said. So, you know, I also give it 10 stars. It's, like, the best X-Men movie, probably. The best, like of the traditional cast doing traditional X-Men things.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Twists. Yeah. There's clever twists, great acting, great
actors.
Makes
sense the whole way through. Yeah. It's compelling to watch.
Still holds up, you know. Very satisfying. Looking forward to X-Men 3, right?
Yep.
Or maybe not. I don't know. I have not watched that in many years. It's going to be really terrible, I think. Maybe not. Maybe it'll be good. I don't know.
X3? Yeah. X-Cubed? The third X-Men?
Yeah. Well, we've yapped for almost 2 hours now, so I'll just very quickly... That's enough.
Yep.
If you've made it this long, we love you. You're a true fan. The answer to the secret question on the website will be 7. just kidding. I don't know what I'm talking about. But anyway, you can follow me on Twitter at Willie Simpson. I forgot my own name. Join the X-Men fan group, X-Men Task Podcast. Also, rate and review us 5 stars on iTunes if you like. Help us go a long way. And also, what else do I want to say to everybody? Thank you for listening. Or
see you next time.
See you next time. Goodbye, everybody. Bye. Oh, we'll be back with more to finish up season 3 in the coming weeks. Back to our regularly scheduled program. Goodbye.
Bye.